I'd like to welcome everybody to the Thursday night, November 18th, 2021, So They Say, House of Prayer Call. And this is your moderator, Daniel. We're going to do things a little bit differently tonight. Tonight we're going to have a topic, but I'd like to make it more available for people to share and question during the call. I know that was sort of mayhem a couple weeks ago, so I am going to play moderator. And if things get out of hand, I'll jump in and pull things back in and reach them in. But currently and presently, we're scheduled for another call. Somebody might want to mute their phone after we get some background noise. That might be, I don't know where that might be coming from. It might have been a 479-445 number. I don't know. So we're going to have our next call. Just going to announce it right off the front for everyone that's here on what's called the second day of December. So that's our next House of Prayer call. And I want to remind everybody, this is our mission statement tonight. That's Isaiah 58:6, the chosen fast, which is to loose the band of wickedness, to undo the heavy burden, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. Now, I've listened to that, and I've said it about every single House of Prayer call I've ever had. It's a tall order, but I believe that we've been aligned in this time and space and in this particular era. For such a time as this, for whatever obstacles we see in front of us, God has called us worthy to be standing in this time. So I love you all out there and all of the parts that you play in our freedom and our liberty. And let you know that if I do hear the noise coming through, I'm going to mute you out on the line here, but not to be rude. I just want to keep the call going and keep the noise level down for the recording, because there are people that will not be able to participate tonight. I've been notified. And secondly, we've had a change in the dial-in number, and it might cause some stragglers to come in late, the new number being taken place, 717-908-1834, with a callback playback number of 908-1837. I also sent out a publication. If you received the email of this call, there is another number. I'm not sure who hosts that number, but you can call a call-in number ahead of time for people that have had a hard time getting on the call and have not been able to call on. We have this third-party phone call message that we can call through first and then access the call, and that's 716-293-9622. And then after it prompts you, you can put in the 717-908-1834. So if you have friends or relatives that have been trying to access the House of Prayer call and not been able to get on, that has provided some relief. In fact, Dave said he's been using it consistently because where he was at, he was unable to access the free conference call HD number. That's all the administration.
I was able to access this one directly, though. So the new number I can access.
Yeah, maybe that new number actually has enabled more people to get on. Not sure why they did that, but they've got a new free conference call HD phone number. Well, tonight we're going to talk about and surround the issues about special appearance and citizenship and relate our relationship to the powers that were on relationship to those two topics and see where it goes. It's going to be a free-for-all. I'm fairly certain that Ed will be able to say something, especially since we've already previously talked about that. And John will probably have things to say, as well as Harold and Dave and myself and maybe Chad. And if I didn't mention you, you are more than actually welcome and encouraged to participate in an orderly fashion tonight. I'm going to have Doyle do a reading. But before I do any of that, I have Dr. William James Smith, who's been on our call, and he was the one that gave the expose on the COVID information that was so exceptional. And if you haven't heard that, you can go to myhousehallbecalled.com, go over to the call recordings tab on the right side of the screen, and scroll down till you see the publicized William James Smith COVID call that was exceptional. And he's got an update for us. Are you on there, Bill?
I am. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, it's good. Go for it.
Okay. Yes, so this past Tuesday, the Fayetteville City Council was deciding to meet again to discuss the mask ordinance, which I had been arrested for violating. and they were going to discuss voting to remove the mask ordinance. And so I thought I should be at that meeting there. So I called my friend who's on the city council and asked if I was, first of all, if I was banned from City Hall. And she said I was not, thankfully. And I said, okay, I'll be there. So the city council and the mayor had no idea I'd been collecting evidence against them. And I had collected photos of pretty much all the city council members, the mayor, the head of the Board of Health for the city of Fayetteville, the Fayetteville school superintendent, and many other people who were in violation of the city's mask ordinance policy. And I got up before the city council, and I had 5 minutes to go over the evidence that I had. And I just went one by one showing pictures with dates and locations of when these violations of the mask ordinance had taken place. And I was calling them out for their hypocrisy because these politicians, these leaders, they like to tell us to do things, and then they don't even follow their own ordinances. They're hypocrites. So I called them out on that. The head doctor in Fayetteville, who's the head of the Board of Health, I had a picture in particular of her sitting in front of a sign that's stating you need to wear a mask and you need to stay 6 feet apart, and she was doing neither of those things. And it was a perfect summary of the tyranny that they've been putting the citizens through, especially myself. And I also had other evidence from the Fayetteville Board of Health, their meeting minutes. And in particular, I read directly off of the Fayetteville Board of Health meeting minutes, where it stated that after the football games at the University of Arkansas, where, you know, there's 75,000 people in the stadium and people tailgating, and usually there's about 200,000 extra people who come to town for those games, there was no increase in cases. That was directly from the Board of Health. And then on those same meeting minutes, it said that from their evidence, what they could see was that the Delta variant died out after 8 weeks. I read them that statement, just read them a lot of evidence directly off of their own meeting minutes. And by the time I was done, the last picture I ended on was of the mayor violating the city ordinance. And he told me to stop talking. They'd turn off his microphone, and I just responded. I said, if you're going to make an ordinance, you at least need to abide by your own ordinance. And a police officer was coming up to take me away, and I left the stand. But the whole time they said I had to wear a mask to be there, and I decided, well, I'll have a little fun with this. So I wore a gas mask to the city council meeting, and that got quite a reaction. And after I was done testifying, the city council voted unanimously 7-0 to get rid of the mask ordinance. And so it was a huge victory. We were vindicated, and I have they know I have plenty of evidence if they do decide to go take me to court to make them look really, really bad. So that's the strategy I took this time around. It wasn't trying to convince them that masks worked or masks didn't work. It was just to show that they violate their own laws, because it's not about health. It's just about control. So that was a big victory. I was interviewed by the local ABC news station after that. And I did give an interview, and the portion of the interview that they aired, I basically said that I'm not a child, I'm an adult, and as an adult, you have the right to make decisions for what you think is best for you, regardless of whether or not those decisions are harmful. I said, as an adult, I do not need the city council or any government to be my parent. I'm an adult, I'm going to have a right to make decisions, whether or not you agree with those decisions. And so that was what happened on Tuesday. So big victory that God gave us. So that's the update.
Yeah, that is a good update. So you wore an actual military gas mask to the city council meeting?
Well, it wasn't quite military grade, but it had the charcoal canisters with the filters, the full face shield, all in one. It's a big mask. Yeah.
Did you take it off to speak?
Yeah, I got permission from the mayor beforehand. I knew he would let me take the mask off, but I approached the microphone. I said, "Mayor, can I take this mask off so you can hear me speak?" He's like, "Of course you can take the mask off." And I wanted to point out that, this virus is so deadly. When it's aerosolized, it can get into the mucous membranes in your eyes. And those masks you guys are wearing, they won't protect you. Just to, troll them a little bit, but I didn't do that.
You remind me of Luke 11 when you talked about these city council members, and where Jesus was being really kind to the lawyers by saying, "Woe unto you also, ye lawyers, for you laid men with burdens grievous to be borne, and you yourselves touch not the burdens with one of your fingers."
Mm-hmm.
Legislating for the city, and you got them all doing the things that they were legislating. Very interesting.
That's right, and I think that's a very effective approach to take on this, because you're not going to convince these people that masks don't work, and you're not going to convince these people that the vaccines are ineffective. And so you have to catch them in their hypocrisy, and that they have no defense because they're trying to defend against their own actions. And pictures are worth a million words at that point, whenever everybody sees it for what it is. And I think that's a good way to attack the lives with their own words and actions.
Trying to get a good mental picture of this, Bill, you went out there with pictures of all of the city council. Were there seven of them there?
Yeah, that's correct.
And how many pictures did you have?
Oh, I probably had 35 pictures.
How large?
8x10, the biggest I could get printed the same day.
Were you passing them around or holding them up?
I was holding them up, so I hauled them up to the mayor, to the camera, and then I knew the news station was there, so I turned around and showed the audience and the news camera.
Well, that's we're very thankful for you and for God's grace on your ministry there of for all of our liberty. May the people in our area and on this phone call get the courage to stand up, because if we don't stand up, who's going to stand up? So thank you so much for being there, Bill. And if you feel like coming back on, I'm going to put you on the spot here, and if you've got any updates that you feel like you want to bring, you're welcome to share an update right now. We do have another agenda tonight. If you have anything new that's come across your desk that you think that the people need to hear, we are open for it, because this is affecting every one of us on a regular basis every day. So
I would just add quickly that things are progressing over in Europe. We need to keep a close eye on that, because within the last week, Austria has put unvaccinated people into lockdown. The Czech Republic has placed unvaccinated people into lockdown, and Germany is going to be placing their unvaccinated citizens into lockdown. This is just the start of, the new Holocaust. The unvaccinated are the new Jews in our society, and they're going to be, I think, before too long, transported off to quarantine camps, and some great atrocities are going to take place. So we need to speak up. It'll be too late. Once they lock down the unvaccinated population, there won't be much chance for us to fight back. So fight while you still can.
Wow, that's very sobering, Bill. Very sobering. Well, thank you for standing up for those that are too timid to stand up. Of course, I'm sure everybody on this call is doing their part. At least I sure hope and pray that you are. And if you're not, this gives you some encouragement to do something in your general area. And I just do believe that God put us in this time, in this place, in this situation, and our answer for what we do, for all our acts and our omissions before the great judge of the universe, is prime and most important for every one of us, because we are eternal beings that belong. So thanks again, Bill. Anything else in parting you want to say? Because I don't want to take away your fire.
No, I think that's it.
Well, thank you again. Anybody got any questions for Bill before he? I don't know if he can stay on for the call or not. So, does anybody have any questions for Bill?
This is John. I got a little something there that since he has all those pictures of all of the other people not living up to the statute, if they decide not to drop the case against him, he can show those pictures in court and plead unequal application of the law. So the law,
yeah, and that's exactly what I plan on doing.
Okay.
Beautiful. Anybody else out there?
I'd like to make a quick comment.
Go for it, Chad.
I just want to say, thank you, Bill. I admire what you're doing, and I would guess if we could all give you a standing ovation, we probably would.
He is not by any means performed by his fellow man without his consent. All right, I recently used that already. Okay,
I'm going to call. I got somebody on the background noise. I'm not sure what's going on there, but I'm trying to figure it out.
He's on the conference call, so his organization does this every week. I just haven't been in on the call. But yeah, his voice sounds like it.
We can all hear you there. I don't know who you are, but if you could mute yourself out.
602 area code. 602 area code.
I was trying to say they're trying to talk to me. Hold on. Yeah, I'm on mute.
Please.
Hello?
Please mute. Please mute.
I got him. It was 954 area code. I got it. Yeah, sometimes. That was 954-799 number, and I just didn't pop up until the very end, Ed. So. Thank you, Bill, for that.
Yeah, okay. Bill, I've got a quick question on this note.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for that, Doctor. I've got my better half is getting ready to fly to Colombia, where she's from, to do some business. I'm concerned the exemption, the religious exemption that you have, is that cover just the U.S., or would that cover her going down there, because she's telling me they're going to, she's going to have to take, she's already messed up and taken the 2 months ago. So far, it looks like she might have slipped through the crack. It might have been just the neutral saline placebo, no side effects. I'm trying to keep her and wake her up, and she's maybe forced to doing the booster. Well, if I can get her an exemption to take down to Colombia, would that cover her down there?
Well, I'll tell you what, I will answer that. Bill, do you want to just touch on it? Do you have anything you want to say to that?
I'm not aware of how the exemptions would work overseas, just primarily here within the United States. So I don't think I'd be qualified to answer that question for overseas exemptions.
Now, here's what I'll say to that. Thank you, Bill. My answer to that would be the same as Bill's, except with this. My religion doesn't have boundaries. My relationship with God is not identified by specifically the United States or Canada or UK or Brazil. My relationship with God is not for sale. So a religious exemption that you're standing on is the fact that I can't do A because of B, or I can't do B because of A, however you want to look at it. So, at some point in time in our lives, each one of us may be called upon to draw the line in the sand and say to Caesar, I'm sorry, but I have one king, like they said in Acts chapter 17. We have one king, and you're not it. Last I checked, you, as David so eloquently said many months ago in his calls, I've not seen you turn water into wine. I haven't seen you heal the sick, raise the dead. Now, who are you to me? How do you claim to be my judge? So I believe the principle applies, but whether or not the exemption will be honored by the high contracting parties of those in Brazil on relation to coming back and forth, I don't know. Hence, you know, maybe if that such is a concern, the trip might want to be forestalled based upon, you know, the turbulent, troubled times we're in. That's about the best I can do. And as far as its efficacy with Brazil, we're having struggles to have our own countrymen, as they might want to be called. I'd have other words for them, but we're having troubles for them to honor and respect the most basics of human rights in our neighborhood and so much more in other locations, as Dr. Bill just put out. So one would have to be real cautious about where one goes. The doctor that I'm learning from went from one of the side things that I do with some health equipment, went to a trip for Russia, and it's taken her a couple months to come back. And I just wanted to get back here. This is her home now. She was a Russian, and she's made her home and had her family in America, but she's had a hard time getting back. I guess what she's saying, that now the only thing that they're requiring is a PCR test for her to get back from Russia into America, and I hope and trust and pray that she's correct in that. I myself wouldn't be going far from home in this particular climate. I would find something else to do myself. But that's about all I can offer. Anybody else have anything they want to say to that? This is an open forum tonight with decency and order in mind.
Speaking of the last speaker, John had told me about a recent Supreme Court case or that's heading up where the federal district court had stopped the mask mandates until it goes to the Supreme Court. But I don't know what the name of the case is if John does. I think it started in Alaska.
Actually, I read that the OSHA people shut the mask mandate down for employers and stuff just here, like, yesterday.
And I believe you guys are referring to the vaccine mandate from OSHA, not the mask mandate.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, that's true, vaccine mandate.
Yeah, so that kind of coincides with his argument that he's been making for the past months, with the people he's been dealing with in his state. So I just wanted to bring that up, that I believe that the vaccine mandate is going to fail constitutionally. I'm sure of it. It's just a matter of how long it takes to get it. But they have put in a stay order right now as far as the vaccine mandate, as far as I'm aware. That's all I had to offer.
Yeah, and the White House's official response today was to ignore the court's holds on the vaccine mandate. They said that employers are still required to push through with the vaccination mandate. So the White House is completely ignoring the court system.
Yeah. Yeah, they've gone off the rails a long time ago.
Yes. Well, I'm sorry to cut everything short. I've got company at visiting at my house, so I'm going to have to leave the call this evening. But I'll try and be back on the next call.
Thank you. It's coming on beat on December 2nd. Thank you for joining and stepping in with us, Bill. Appreciate you.
All right. Thank you. God bless you, guys.
Yeah, God bless you. So what do you think that's all about with this White House that is creating their own regime that's contrary to any semblance of any order in the United States? Anybody got any intelligent designed opinions about that?
Impeachable treason.
Okay, who's gonna impeach?
Well, I'd impeach him.
Yeah,
I'd give
no
more than a peach. I'd give more than a peach. I'd give more than a peach, but go ahead.
Yeah, the separation of powers doctrine has been thrown out. Yeah.
All right, well, one at a time. I couldn't hear you, Ed. I couldn't hear Dave or Ed.
Yeah, I was just saying that Dave was saying all fraud. And I said the doctrine of separation of powers has been completely thrown out the window. In other words, they've given us all legislative courts, but now they're saying the administration is saying to ignore the courts. So on the one hand, they're stealing all our rights away, And on the other hand, they're saying that they can ignore what the courts have to say about anything that affects the administration. So it's kind of a don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining type of doctrine is what I would call it. Dave?
Could this develop into another Nuremberg?
All those folks that have gotten this vaccine by threats and coercion and lies, you know, how often have we seen it? Anyone who's been alive for any length of time can see that, you know, this election cycle, they put stuff in place. The next election cycle, they repeal it or work to repeal it. And it's just a big back and forth, and nobody ever gets held accountable, but it's all a giant fraud.
Hello?
Greetings. You're unmuted. You had something to share?
Yeah, I was talking to my husband and realized that y'all were trying to speak to me earlier, and I was talking to him, and I didn't hear you until you muted me again. My number is 954-799-1634. That's a Florida number, but I'm actually in Texas. This is Andre Media, Robinson, Washington, Bill of Rights office in Florida, Texas. And I wanted to mention a recent occurrence of a woman in my church. They scare the elders and the hospice and nursing homes and got them all to take the COVID-19. Well, she passed away of the vaccine. The second round of vaccine completely took her appetite. And then she went into self-starvation and recently passed away and just recently had her funeral.
That's an awful thing to share, have to hear, and it's an awful thing to happen. We certainly share your grief.
Yes.
We've been told by the news media that's not the vaccine that did that. So you can rest assured the news media said the vaccine is safe. I've heard it.
they're claiming the vaccine to be safe
and effective.
That's what they're claiming.
Oh yeah, that's the claims. I've heard it. I've seen it. I've heard the reports. I've been indoctrinated by it. I haven't bought into it, but I've heard it.
No way. I have unrefutable information from Freedom School that will knock that all the way down, and from another reputable site as well. Involving clinicians and so on like that, and unrefutable research evidence to prove contrary. She's not the only one.
That's what we do.
I mean, I know of a few, you know, that have had adverse effects, and you know, it circulates when they try to hide it about how many have died, including medical professionals. From that, and the honest doctors and medical professionals are warning not to take that. See, it goes deeper than that. You know, it causes transhumanism and it alters your DNA. Like I said, I have unrefutable evidence that no one can shoot down to prove why it's not safe. It is part of the Agenda 21 depopulation plan. Rest assured, make no mistake about it.
Thank you. You're pretty much, you've got some, I'm pretty sure that most everybody, I'd be really surprised if anybody came to the House of Prayer call that didn't side with you. So you're amongst friends, and I was just smarting off for the sake of effect. So thank you for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got another agenda tonight, believe it or not. Ooh, okay, go ahead. There's somebody else.
John, this is John. I heard a... an interesting fact the other day, and basically what it amounted to. Do you remember how Joan was telling us how they counted the cases and all that kind of stuff, Dr. Priestley, when she was on the other day?
Great call.
So the way they're counting the if somebody has a reaction or dies or something from the vaccine, they don't count them. Unless they die 2 weeks after the vaccine. So if anybody dies really quick, they don't count that. They only count them 2 weeks later. So the numbers we actually hear are bogus. They're not including the ones that die relatively quick. I've known two or three people that have died like 2 hours after the second shot or something like that. You know, it's ridiculous. Anyway, I pass.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Yeah, and I do believe that Bill touched on that as well when he came and shared with us. For you all information, there are two really good calls to share with your loved ones. If you're still anybody that's, I can't imagine being on the fence still now. Right now, it's there's so much information out there for people to get their hands on. But Bill Smith and Dr. William James Smith and Joan Priestley are on the House of Prayer website, myhouseshallbecalled.com, for download and for sharing. So, moving right along, Doyle, are you with us? He said he was going to be here and ready to speak, so I might have to wake him up. Doyle, are trying to reach you for the reading, if you're there.
I'm here.
All right, Doyle. So what we're gonna do tonight is we're going to start a conversation by having Doyle read from, this is a little bit dry, but he's going to read it with life and flavor and the best he can with intonation for understanding, out of Corpus Juris Secundum on the topic of special appearance, which is going to be the topic of discussion for the rest of the evening. And I know that Ed's got quite a bit to say, and I know John will probably say some, and there's others. So if we could just, everybody hold on to your hat, try to listen real well. We're going to have Doyle read us, and hopefully it won't be a bedtime story. So wake yourself up, sit up, shake your head, whatever it takes to stay awake. Doyle, it's all you.
Okay, I'm going to be reading from the Corpus Juris Secundum, The Appearance, a volume, which is volume number 6, if anybody wants to follow along in their CJS. We're going to go to section 4, where it's talking about general or special appearance. Okay. A general appearance is one whereby the party appears and submits to the court's jurisdiction for all purposes, while a special appearance is made for the sole purpose of questioning the court's jurisdiction by virtue of some statutes or rules. Such distinction has in effort been abolished. Okay, research note. Determination of nature of appearance as general or special and change of special appearance to into general one are discussed infra subsection 6 through 7. Particular acts will... Go ahead.
No, Doyle, it was somebody that... I'm going to mute him out because we had some noise. It's okay. Go ahead.
Particular acts or proceedings as constituting general or special appearance are considered infra subsection 18, ATSEQ. Right to appear specially is discussed infra subsection 5, which I think we'll probably cover that. Okay, right to appear specially. Okay, I'm going to talk, or it's going to talk about generally and general appearance and special appearance in this next section. Okay, generally, appearances have been classified as either general or special. However, by virtue of some statutes or rules, the traditional distinction between a general and special appearance has largely lost its significance and has, in effect, been abolished. And it has been held that for purpose of answering or defending under a court rule pertaining to the method of presentation of defenses and objections, there is only one kind of appearance, and its nature is such that personal jurisdiction can be litigated. An appearance is general where it is an absolute submission to the jurisdiction of the court, or defendant takes any substantive step in the proceedings, or, as noted, infra, subsection 19, does some act which recognizes the case as in court, which is made or done for any purpose other than to question the jurisdiction thereof, and which bears some substantial relation to the cause. Such appearances must be expressed or arise by implication from the defendant seeking, taking, or agreeing to some step or proceeding in the cause beneficial to himself or detrimental to the plaintiff, other than one contesting the jurisdiction only. The fact that an appearance is compulsory does not prevent it from being general, although some suggestions may be found to the contrary. A special appearance, while not regarded as an appearance at all for such or some purposes, is one which is made for the sole purpose of objecting to the jurisdiction of the court over the person of defendant, on the ground that such jurisdiction is lacking because of a want of process, illegality or invalidity thereof, defects in the process or the service, variance between the complaint and summons, or because the action was brought in their own county or judicial district. Okay, right to appear specially. Where there is no statute to the contrary, the right of a party to appear specially to object to the jurisdiction of the court over his person and have that question determined in limine is generally recognized. However, this right is not substantial one inherently existing, where a cause of action can be divided into rem and in personam actions. A party may appear specially to contest the rem jurisdiction of the court if he chooses. A special appearance for want of jurisdiction of the subject matter will not lie where the court has jurisdiction of one of the pleaded causes of action, but not of all, or has jurisdiction of part of the action, but not its entirety. Any rule or procedure prescribing the method for making a special appearance must be followed. Leave of court is not necessary. Leave of court is not necessarily a prerequisite to the right to make a special appearance, and it has been held error for the court to refuse the privilege, although it has been also held that such appearance can be made only after leave of court obtained upon proper and sufficient application or petition, and if such leave is not first obtained, the special appearance is regarded as amounting to a general appearance. Plaintiff who fails to object to filing of an amended special appearance without leave of court waives any right to contend subsequently that such special appearance constitutes a general appearance. Defendant will not be absolved from the requirement of obtaining leave of court by stipulation that the complainant preserving his right to appear specially. The application and order granting the leave to appear specially may be made ex parte, and it has been held that the fact that an application for leave to file a special appearance was entertained by a person other than one required by rule of court does not require that the order granting the leave be vacated. Where leave of court is required, it is sometimes the practice of the court, before it will grant leave to appear specially or make any decisions upon the jurisdictional question, to require defendant to stipulate that he will enter a general appearance to the jurisdiction without further process if the decision is against him on the jurisdictional questions. The imposition of such requirement by rule of court, however, is improper where a statute gives a defendant the right to appear specially or specially to object to the jurisdiction. The mere fact that an attorney for an insurance company is appearing in defense of an insured gives the attorney no right to enter a special appearance in the absence of some jurisdictional objection forming a proper basis Therefore, where the terms of the insurance policy under which he is acting authorizes a general appearance. Third person, having a proper and legal interest to protect and preventing the rendition of a judgment against the defendant without due and legal service of process are entitled to appear specially and object to the jurisdiction of the court to render the judgment. And that's 4 and 5. Now, I talked about determination of nature here, too, as well.
Okay, you got more? You got more to read? Go ahead.
Well, there's section 6 talks about nature, determination of the nature. I'll read this, the synopsis of it, if you guys want to go into it more further detail, I can do that. This is subsection 6, determination of nature. Although a designation of an appearance as special is important by reason of its tendency to refute the presumption that an appearance is general, it is not determinative of the character of the appearance. If the appearing party asks relief on or discloses a purpose which goes beyond questioning the jurisdiction of the court, the appearance is general, no matter what it may be called or designated. On the other hand, when a consideration of the substance discloses that the only purpose is to question the jurisdiction of the court over the defendant's person, the appearance is special, even though it may not expressly be so designated. And I close with that.
Now, that was a pretty important addition there. We've talked about that on this call, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago. So there's a lot of words all jumbled together, but you want to, since you were reading it, you want to take away your summary before we open up to the peanut patch?
Well, what I take away from what I just read is that if you're going to challenge the jurisdiction of the court, you need to first request leave of court and then go from there. I think just going into the court, appearing in the court and then claiming that you're there under special appearance would not give you the proper cover. It's what I take away from what I just read.
I've taken that away too. We've been talking about that. I'd like to see and open it up to a couple of our law students and people on this call and see if they disagree.
Can I make a comment?
Comment away.
Okay, the thing I took away from the reading, and it was mentioned twice, it stated the defendant's person. It didn't say the defendant, it said the defendant's person. What did they mean by that? Because just listening to it, it sounds like the defendant and the person are two separate things. And which is
they
under
are,
the jurisdiction of the who was that?
That was Dave.
What
I just said that they are.
Yes. Yeah, I know. But I'm just listening to it. Say it again, Dave.
That person is the legal person. That's who they're. You know, talking about there, and you're right, it's not the man or the woman, it's the legal person, the legal fiction.
Correct. And this is one reason why I no longer use special appearance at all. When I go in, they call the name, I'm here for that matter. Well, who are you? I'm the attorney, in fact, for the legal person. And I have proof here. Well, actually, the proof will already precede me. And generally, they can't handle that. Because you're not acknowledging the name. You're not acknowledging the name in joinder or in suretyship. So what do they have to cling on to? Yeah, you can have jurisdiction over the person all day long, as long as it's not over me. Because my thing is, even asking for leave of the court, you're basically saying that the court has jurisdiction over you. And I disagree with that. It doesn't have jurisdiction over me. And the legal person can't appear except on paper or on a computer screen. These may sound like ticky-tack points, but I can tell you from my experience, they hold court cases up. I got one right now in Virginia. They can't get around the name issue. I attacked the name issue right from the jump. They can't get around it. I got some mail. I got some mail today that was in my post office box, but actually was supposed to be delivered to the house. But I don't get mail at the house. The house is out of the USPS registry. They don't deliver here. Only at the post office box. But because the post office personnel know who I am, they often put in mail that's addressed to the house into the P.O. box. Well, I had returned some mail to the court because of wrong name and wrong address. They returned it again. They changed the name, but it's still the wrong name and still the wrong address, and I just returned that today. And nothing is going forward with this case until that name gets resolved. And you got to hold them to the fire. You got to get them to acknowledge that you are not it. That's why I like the ANC for beginners, because that's what that does. It shows that you are not it. I digress.
No, everybody has a voice here, and we're all here together to share, to learn, to hear. I hear what you're saying, and I believe it has merit, and I'm not saying it's not valid. I personally don't look at leave of court as me asking for anything. In fact, I'm just as a counterpoint, I can see where leave of court would be one way to respectfully address a matter by special appearance, because the purpose of the leave of court is that there is jurisdictional defects. However, I see the validity of what you had to share. Now, that being said, go ahead, Harold.
I was going to say there's something in CJS that brings up the point, and I can't recall the section offhand, that when you answer or appear, it essentially knocks out anything or any kind of objection that you are not it just by you being there.
Yeah, so that's a maxim that says appearance cures all defects in process.
Yes.
And so what we're talking about is appearance by non-appearance, and I'm highly recommending non-appearance. And we're going to talk about this just a little bit. I think you might appreciate it, and I think it might be, well, first of all, once you go down a certain path and make it your favorite path, it's kind of hard to change scenery and go down a different path. So I'm certainly not asking you to change your opinion, and I wanted to hear your opinion, and I believe everybody here will learn from it and make up their own mind. with that being said, if it's all right with everybody, Ed, I just want to know if you're chomping at the bit to speak or if you want David to read the special appearance now and hold your thoughts, because I know I can almost feel you wanting to speak.
Well, I just want to – I'm going to speak to something the first speaker said. But on this issue that what he's saying, we've got a saying in the Southeast, as just sanguinous American state nationals, we don't make motions, we make demands. So what about a demand for leave of court by special appearance? How would that affect what Harold was saying? It's not a request, it's a demand.
Well, right between request and demand is a requirement. I learned from a wise Buddhist monk years ago, there's three ways you can go. request, require, demand in that order. I think we can skip the request based upon the fact that who are they to deny me a right to challenge a jurisdiction like Doyle Red? Now, I like require, and I think that you can also go as far as to say demand. I have no issue with that if you want to just come right up, right at the matter as a bull in a china cabinet. But I do like what Harold had to say. I get it, Ed.
He makes a good point, and I've got something to say about the name. You know, obviously, when it's my turn to talk, I've got something to say about that name. But I would like to use this opportunity to tell everybody to get a pen, a piece of paper, because I've got several things that I want to share, especially about receiving mail at your domicile and what I do here to thwart the presumption that I live in a federal zone. So once David gets through reading the notice of leave of court by special appearance, then I will I'll speak then. Thank you.
Beautiful, Ed. There you go, Dave. I just felt that Ed was pulling on me there. I don't know why. I'm not psychic. I'm not alleging. Maybe I just dealt with Ed enough to know that there's pressure that gets built up. You've got to let it go.
Thank you,
Dave. I agree with you. And
we love you, Ed.
Harold, I do agree that, you know, I don't believe that we should be asking their permission for leave of court as well. And, you know, I don't motion, I notice. And Daniel and I worked on this document, which I'm going to read here for everyone so that we can get it down on this recording. Can everybody hear me okay?
Beautiful here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, so this is a judicial notice of leave of court by way of special appearance and ecclesiastical visitation, to wit. Requirement for declaratory judgment, for declaratory judgment in reference to the abandoned paper, a couple of tickets that I received. See caveat at the end of this document. Greetings, and I sent this to Greg Gianforte, the governor of Montana, Austin Knutson, the attorney general. Now, these are all actors. Jennifer Ray acting as justice of the peace. Bill Fulbright acting as county attorney. And Paige Troutwine, who is acting as the clerk of the court. In the name of Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ, Galatians 15:18. But if you are led by the Spirit, then you are not in subjection to the system that results from perverting the Torah into legalism. Pretty apropos. Comes now a peaceful servant and ambassador of God, commissioned to reconcile all things unto God in the name and authority of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ. Created in the image and likeness of God, a spiritual man led by the Holy Spirit of God, a new creation given a new name which no man knows except my Father in heaven. Witnessed and known by my friends in the community of believers as David, and the name of the family of souls to which I owe my DNA heritage is Horowitz. As certain agents and employees of the state of Montana have invited participation within their state financial and commercial scheme, and it is presumed that they invited this man of God to appear, this man of God hereby gives notice of his requirement of leave of court in relation to the abandoned paper citations to commence a hearing by special appearance and to exercise my duty to the beneficiaries of my trust and to my Master, Lord, King, and Owner, Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ, to owe no man anything but to love them. This is a requirement for an administrative hearing to be docketed to hear this declaratory judgment and challenge to the jurisdiction of the state of Montana, United States, over God's property, and is not to be construed as a voluntary or general appearance or the submission to the jurisdiction. And it that was a Freudian slip that I left in there and actually came up with a definition for, but jurisdiction. So All right, of any court in citation numbers, blah, blah, blah. But it is a special appearance to challenge personal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, and sufficiency of service of process. The below undersigned spiritual man claims that there is a mistake as to the personal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, as well as sufficiency of service of process in that. One, personal jurisdiction challenge. The below undersigned spiritual man, 1 Corinthians 2:14 and 15, belongs to Yeshua HaMashiach as a single-minded bondservant, steward, slash trustee, and is indentured to and subject to none other than God and his Torah, or his law, or instruction. The state of Montana, United States, nor any agent or agency thereof, notwithstanding. Do those who act in agency, and this is the question to the court, do those who act in agency for the state of Montana possess any evidence to the contrary to the above stated indenture by contract or agreement? Challenge two, the below undersigned spiritual man has no awareness of any evidence and believes no evidence exists to demonstrate a compelling state interest, power of attorney, consent, or otherwise permission for the state of Montana through any agency therein to capitalize upon the undersigned's beneficial interest in the estate of the all caps name within the commercial scheme of the state of Montana. If there were any recipient of this communication, which by effect is a challenge to the jurisdiction and a demand to the nature and cause, has any evidence to the contrary of any of the specifically pled material facts herein, you are herewith requested to demonstrate by material evidence that element of joinder and nexus between state of Montana and the undersigned spiritual man. Personal jurisdiction challenge three, it is always the intent of the undersigned spiritual man to fulfill the law and commandment of God to love my neighbor as myself, and therefore it is never my intent to harm another. If by accident I do harm another, let him or her make their claim upon the testimony of two or three witnesses, and if found to be true, I will make them whole, restoring them to their previous state. Do those who act in agency for the state of Montana possess any tangible material evidence of loss or proof of claim of any injury or damage done to any of the people of the state of Montana, United States, by the undersigned spiritual man? Subject matter jurisdictional challenge one. The below undersigned spiritual man is a citizen of heaven in the diaspora and a sojourner in the land commonly known as Montana, within the landmass commonly known as North America. Do those who act in agency for the state of Montana possess any evidence to the contrary that contradicts the heavenly citizenship expressed above and herein? Subject matter challenge two. I, a spiritual man, govern myself according to the laws of God and administrate as trustee steward with sole subject matter jurisdiction over the things entrusted to my care by my creator, by my grantor, Heavenly Father, in order to fulfill the command of God to leave an inheritance for my children and children's children. No other trustees exist or have subject matter jurisdiction over the res of this Kingdom of Heaven trust, everlasting covenant, irrevocable trust between Almighty God and the undersigned spiritual man. Do those who act in agency for the state of Montana possess any evidence or claim that the undersigned spiritual man acts as a trustee for their state of Montana, any other instrumentality of the United States, thereby serving two masters? Do those who act in agency for the state of Montana possess any evidence or proof of claim to the property in the trusteeship and thereby within the possession of the undersigned spiritual man? Challenge three, subject matter. The below undersigned spiritual man owes his entire allegiance to one lawgiver and judge, as it is written in the scriptures in James 4:12. Do those who act in agency for the state of Montana possess any tangible material evidence or proof that those laws, statutes, codes, acts, regulations, constitutions of their private society confer any debt, duty, or obligation upon him? If the answer is yes, identify the time, date, and witnesses to this event related to the conveyance whereby God pledged, gifted, or sold his property in the below undersigned spiritual man to be as a surety for or use as chattels to or for the state of Montana or the United States. Subject matter challenge four. The below undersigned spiritual man believes in accordance with 1 Corinthians 2:15, the man with the spirit makes judgments about all things, but such a man is not subject to merely human judgments. Does it not say in your law, Title I, Section 15 of the Justice Manual, the free exercise of religion includes the right to act or abstain from action in accordance with one's religious beliefs? Does it not also say, to the greatest extent practicable and permitted by law, department components and United States attorneys' offices must reasonably accommodate religious observance and practice in all activities, including litigation. Sufficiency of service challenge. The below undersigned spiritual man has never knowingly, willingly, intentionally, with full disclosure of all consequences thereof, acted in any agency or principal capacity as the in legis persona, known as my all caps name, at any time within the borders commonly referred to as State of Montana, United States. Do those who act in agency for the State of Montana possess any evidence or claim that the undersigned spiritual man possesses any capacity other than beneficiary of the in legis persona, known as my all caps name, or my name in all caps? As one of the brethren and a trustee steward of the Heavenly Trust, I would be remiss of my duties and obligations to the beneficiaries of my trust if I did not require an administrative show cause hearing by special appearance to answer the jurisdictional challenges made herein. Your custom allows for dispute resolution by way of the State of Montana's Administrative Procedures Act at Montana Title 24501. This is notice of the undersigned appearance by non-appearance for the express purpose to notice of his intent to commence a hearing for declaratory relief to resolve this matter and any like controversies in the future. As an ambassador and trustee steward of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the undersigned spiritual man of God presents the following to your agents in support of his specific denial of his participation as a party within any State of Montana, United States proceedings. Evidence presented as specific denial, a copy of the Bible, and I put public law 97-280. They can pick whatever Bible they want. My declaration and indenture to God, notice of jurisdictional inquiry, and a judicial notice of private trust affidavit. And the caveat at the end, if any man has claimed that my body is subject to personal appearance, notwithstanding all of the claims made herein, and will attempt to force my bodily presence through some act of plenary power, there is no need for violence. Simply alert this man of God by phone, and I will gladly bring the gospel to them at the time appointed. Otherwise, it is my understanding that this notice satisfies your requested appearance. Dated 33 days after Sukkot in the year 5782. Now, this was sent out last week to the court, and today would have been the date of appearance, so I'm sure they received this in time, all of them. So that was the document. I believe that's the end of the document. I may be wrong. Nope, just my signature under seal. So, and I have my own trust seal that I use, and I signed as the ambassador, trustee, servant of my trust.
Will you give a little bit more of a rundown? Will you give a little bit more of a rundown on the items you attached to this, Lee?
Sure.
What they are?
And they're all available. These are things that I give, that I've been handing out for a long time. I've put together a declaration of status. It's a declaration of status, rights, capacity, and social contracts, legal relations. And if anybody wants that doc, you can either get a hold of Daniel or myself. My email is freemaninbabylon@gmail.com. Again, that's freemaninbabylon@gmail.com. And you can just shoot me an email and say that you were on this call and are interested in the three documents that are including this, or 4, including this document, if you'd like a copy. But the Declaration of Status, Capacity, Rights, and Legal Relations is my declaration as what God has already declared. So it's not open for debate or for judicial opinion. Also, there's a notice of jurisdictional inquiry, which further questions them as to their jurisdiction and how they came about it. Then you have a judicial notice of private trust affidavit, which is also a notice of trust, and it shows that I am indentured to my trust, not the public's trust. The only thing I am in the public is, at best, a beneficiary. And a beneficiary owes no duty, no allegiance, and no obligation to the trust at all. None. Does that cover it for you, Ed, or was there some more that you wanted to know?
No, that's great. Obviously, we talked about all this earlier, but I just wanted the other listeners to know what all went with it and where they could get it if they wanted to use the sleeve.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you bringing that up, and I'm like I said, I'm happy to share these documents. Daniel has them. Maybe you'll put them up on the recording, a link to the docs, you know, a download link for the docs.
So you, just for before Ed gets on to share, Dave, you have in there for people to just to bring it a little bit to procedural here. You got in there something about the Administrative Procedures Act. You want to comment on that and expound on that, what your understanding is of that?
I could do that. well, most of the folks on this call know that and I'm sure Ed and John will agree, and Harold and most of the folks on this call, that when you're going into these courts, or these so-called courts, they are administrative tribunals, all of them. In this case, where I'm at, it's an administrative hearing for the Department of Transportation. Okay? And I have no contracts with the Department of Transportation. So, therefore, we have no law between us. So any of these statutes that they're claiming that I violated, I had no obligation to follow in the first place. So the Administrative Procedures Act, if you read through it, I mean, your eyes are going to open wide and go, wow, this is exactly what they're doing in these courts. And all of these, right within the Administrative Procedures Act, you can do a declaratory judgment, and it will stand there. It cannot be objected to. We all have a right to know where we stand and have our rights declared, whether, you know, our rights, our status, our capacity. What capacity am I acting at? So, you know, if you want to relate this to, am I acting in the capacity of a driver when I'm traveling down the road in my private conveyance, knowing that a driver is a commercial term used in their statutes. So they'll always call you a driver and put a label on you, okay? And the driver is a title or an office within the transportation code, you know, for commercial transport. These are things that John does. But the Administrative Procedures Act will give you a really good idea as to being able to go in and start at the bottom floor and literally go in and say, hey, what do I have? You know, what contract do I have with the Department of Transportation? Or if you have one, you can say, you know, like what John did, right? John, you said that basically you went in and had them change it on the record, right? And you could do that through a declaratory action under the Administrative Procedures Act for the Department of Motor Vehicles or Department of Transportation. Is that what you were looking for, Daniel, or there's some sort of more you want to add?
that was really good. I know from experience that John has something to say about the Administrative Procedures Act.
Now, what would make you say that?
Now or later, John?
Never, I'm easy. Let's let Ed go.
Go ahead, Ed.
Okay. All right. Going back to the first speaker, I sent a web link and a copy of a demand notice and warning of commercial grace that's used to send to the governor. I sent it to your email, Daniel and David. David got it. Daniel, you got kicked back. So if anybody wants this, they can get it from David, or David can send it to Daniel later. Demand notice and warning of commercial grace for the COVID issue. I found something from Daniel Webster, who was an American statesman from 1782 to 1852. And again, this is going back to the original speaker that talked about his ordeal that he's had with these vaccine and mask mandates. And this is what he said: "Mr. President, the contest for ages has been to rescue liberty from the grasp of executive power." And that's exactly what we're talking about right now. He said that back in Boston, Little Brown and Company, The Works of Daniel Webster, Volume 9, 10th Edition, in 1857. As for this next citation, "As regards all courts of the United States inferior to this tribunal, two things are necessary to create jurisdiction. The Constitution must have given to the court the capacity to take it, and an act of Congress must have supplied it. Their concurrence is necessary to vest it. It can be brought into activity in no other way." And that's the part I want everybody to remember as I get started tonight: in no other way. The mayor, the site for that case is the Mayor versus Cooper, 73 U.S. 6 Wall, 247 and 252, and that is from 1867. The next one is Osborne versus Bank of the United States, 22 U.S. 738 and 818 and 1824. Notice I'm going earlier and earlier in our history. "The legislative, executive, and judicial powers of every well-constructed government are coextensive with each other. The executive department may constitutionally execute every law which the legislature may constitutionally make, and the judicial department may receive from the legislature the power of construing every such law." Then one of my favorite sites is Pennyover versus Neff, 95 U.S. 714 and 722. This is actually from 1878, so it's a little bit closer to our great-great-grandparents' generation, but it says, "Every state possesses exclusive jurisdiction and sovereignty over persons and property within its territory." This is a point that Harold made a little earlier, and we're going to get into that here in just a minute. My favorite all-time case is Cohens v. Virginia, 19 U.S. 264, 6 Wheat, that's spelled W-H-E-A-T, 265-5, limited edition 257, in this case is from 1821, and it says, "It is clear that Congress as a legislative body exercises two species of legislative power, the one limited as to its objects," which I put in place of that the word subjects, "but extending all over the Union, the other an absolute exclusive legislative power over the District of Columbia." And we're going to get into that in a minute. So that's the case law that I want to start with as I go into this. I've got one more, the Slaughterhouse Cases, 83 U.S. 16 Wall, 36 and 116, and again, this is from 1872. "Rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are equivalent to the rights of life, liberty, and property." If you think about what that's saying there, everything that you own, because you have the rights to life, liberty, and property, you have the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
but yet no one on this phone call tonight, with possibly the exception of me, because what I did last year buying my land with gold, owns their own property, even if they paid cash for it. And I've explained that in other calls here, but we can go over that later. That's not the main income. So the two things that we spoke about earlier that I told Daniel and David and John that I was going to be speaking about tonight, the first one, and get your pens ready, Harold had brought up how he deals with when they try to send him mail to the entity at his domicile. So this is the way I do this. Okay, and you can write this down and use it, and let me tell you, this works with flying colors. So I don't go get a P.O. box or anything like that. I have them send the mail to my house, but the return address on the zip code, I either don't put a zip code in because you don't need it to have your mail delivered to you. The zip code signifies you live in a federal zone, and that makes you subject to being a U.S. citizen. So what I do is I either put brackets around the zip code, or I leave the zip code off. Your preference, it depends on where I'm sending it, but you can either put brackets around the zip code, which means they can't take that into any kind of consideration, or you can just leave it off and you'll still get your mail. I've tested it many times and it works. But this is what I put on the outside of the envelopes. And what these are, folks, when you get a notice of intent to levy from the IRS, or you get a bill, a delinquent bill, or something from a creditor. These are all offers to contract, because you have to remember, everything's in commerce today. These are all offers to contract by various agencies of the government. So what I do is, and I got this idea from Walton, Arizona. We talked about this at length one day, but this is perfect because they have no way to get around it. And basically, so at the beginning, I put return to sender. Okay, so at the top of the envelope, return to sender. And then the next line is no such people, comma, person, comma, decedent, spelled D-E-C-E-D-E-N-T, or corporation at this address, period. And then the next sentence says wishing no contracts, period. Now, a dead entity, a corporation, can't make a wish, but a live man or woman, a living soul, a living, breathing soul, an indentured servant to God Almighty, our Creator, can make a wish. So that's why I use the word wishing there, wishing no contracts. Never had a problem since I started doing that, never got a follow-up letter by any of the agencies. The second thing I want to talk about, and this is I'm not going to take long on this because it's not the main thing I want to talk about tonight, but I recently ran into a PDF by a guy named Frank McDonald. And this guy was a legal researcher for 40 years, and he's what gave me the idea on what I'm about to tell you and what I'm going to tell you. So the name of his PDF, his legal research document, was Notes of Debt Are Not Income. And he was fighting the IRS. But what Frank did that nobody else, I've never even heard of this, but what he did is he got a self-inking stamp in purple ink. And this is what the stamp says. So every time he got his paycheck, or every time he got a check he deposited into a bank, he signed his signature, but he put this on the stamp, deposited for credit on account or exchanged for non-negotiable Federal Reserve notes of face value. So I'm going to repeat that one more time. Deposited for credit on account or exchanged for non-negotiable Federal Reserve notes of face value. Okay? That's what he put on the back of all his paychecks before he deposited them into the bank. The IRS
didn't try to collect anything from him for 25 years, and finally they audited him. And the ending of that, after a 25-year audit of not paying taxes, is he was given a refund by the IRS. He put the stamp on all of his checks but three over that 25-year span. When he got audited, he produced the front and back copies of his paychecks to the IRS auditor. He took a break and came back. The IRS auditor took a break and came back and told him that those checks endorsed that way were not taxable income. When he got in a hurry and open signed three of his checks that he deposited without the stamps, the auditor informed him that those were the only checks that that they said they could tax. That is the and that was the last he ever heard from them. So they didn't even collect on the three checks where he didn't have the stamp. This is a remedy. This is all based upon what is lawful money of value. And HJR, House Joint Resolution 192, that was June 5th, 1933, enacted, that no lawful money of value is in circulation for private use by the public. There are no lawful dollars out there, only credit and debt ledger entries, and no one gets paid for anything with anything of valuable substance. The IRS can't tax credit, debt, or barter, which I believe is where our country's going to end up, is in some form of barter. The Congress licensed the use of Federal Reserve notes to be used as money, as a medium of exchange for discharge of public and private debt into the U.S. bankruptcy. At that point, Federal Reserve notes became contraband, and that gave the BATF and the IRS jurisdiction over its use and transfer, just like trafficking in alcohol, guns, drugs, or tobacco, or other substances subject to excise taxes. There are many types of commercial paper and property, and properly prepared can discharge debt other than Federal Reserve notes, but few know how to use them. Using Federal Reserve notes is licensed money laundering, plain and simple. When you get a check that says dollars on the front, if you endorse it openly, you just testified that you received dollars of valuable substance, and even though there are none, they have jurisdiction over you. So what he did was he corrected the error on the front and converted the check into a bill of exchange by stamping it on the back with deposited for credit on account or exchange for non-redeemable Federal Reserve notes. It's a barter transaction. It becomes a barter transaction of two different kinds of things being traded even up for equal value that are not taxable. There was no sale or financial gain, just a private trade. So I wanted to pass that along to you. Okay, now for the good stuff. This is what I want to talk to everybody about tonight. So I told the guys today, in separate meetings, that we've been asking the wrong question in these Article I legislative and Article IV legislative courts, which are either admiralty or maritime. And we would all argue that they're actually ad hoc jurisdictions where they make up the laws and rules and regulations as they go along. All right, hear me when I say this. No one has ever been a U.S. citizen by law of statute. I'm going to repeat that because it's worth repeating, and this is going to go tie back into what Harold just said a little while ago. No one has ever been a U.S. citizen by law of statute. Person is defined, the word person is defined in all 50 states by statute. They did that on purpose. It was the only way that they could get away with the fraud that they perpetrate on us when they call us into their contract courts and tax us. Essentially, that's what it is. When the government creates a debt against us, it's a tax, and they expect to get paid in that tax. So what I did, I had to go all the way back to 1802 to figure this out, but once I tell you, it's going to hit you like a ton of bricks. I first looked up the definition of presumption, which is also located in your Uniform Commercial Code. They can make presumptions, and this is the 1828 definition, closest I could get to 1802. It's a noun. It's Latin. The Latin phrase is pro assumption. The definition is, it starts, notice the word it starts with, supposition of the truth or real existence of something without direct or positive proof of the fact, but grounded on circumstantial or probable evidence which entitles it to belief. Presumption in law is of three sorts. First, violent or strong presumption. Second, probable presumption. And third, light presumption. And it doesn't matter which one those judges use, they can still make presumptions until you prove otherwise. And this is what had me messed up for a long time, even though I've studied the Constitution as long as I've had. It's the fact that they could make the presumption, but the question is not, can I prove that I'm not a U.S. citizen? The real question we should be asking is, can they prove that we are U.S. citizens? And I'm going to get into that. So remember that the definition for presumption started with the word supposition. I went to a 1913 definition of supposition, which is a noun, but I have no idea where the word came from. Apparently, they invented it around 1913, just before the 1917 Trading with the Enemies Act. And the definition there is the position of something known not to be true or not proved, or a hypothesis. This is only an infallibility upon supposition that if a thing be true, it is impossible to be false. The second definition for the word supposition is imagination, belief without full evidence. I know I'm going fast, but essentially what that means is they can presume anything about you that they want to, and it stands as truth in their commercial court until you prove otherwise. And it was that until you prove it otherwise that I had an issue for so many years. So I had a lady, I was on a podcast in the State Assembly of California last week, who got naturalized. And I told her that there was no such thing as a U.S. citizen. And she actually called me a liar, okay, because she got naturalized and she was indoctrinated into the belief that she has to be a U.S. citizen because that's what she took an oath to be, and she believed that that was all there was to it. It just so happened that she was in the state of California. So from a case called Ex Parte Frank Knowles, 5 Cal Reporter 300, and for those of you that don't know this, that's the Supreme Court of California that the Cal Reporter was reporting. This is what it says in part. A U.S. citizen does not exist and is a fraud under the color of law. It might be correctly said that there is no such thing as a citizen of the United States. This is a direct quote. A citizen of any one of the states of the Union is held to be and called a citizen of the United States, although technically and abstractly there is no such thing. Now, that last part there, technically and abstractly there is no such thing, means there's no such thing as a U.S. citizen. It was made up by the 39th Congress. It was a word of art, as John would call it, term that was made up. Terms are not words. These are terms. So the term U.S. citizen means something much different than you think it does. It basically makes you a debt slave to the corporate system. That's what it does. It was originally intended under the 14th Amendment for slaves, freed slaves, to give them rights. But what they didn't tell you is that your Bill of Rights disappeared, and then over time they made us all 14th Amendment birthright citizens, which made us, that's why when you're born and they issue that birth certificate and that Social Security number, that's why they presume you to be born as a U.S. citizen because of where you were born, in one of their districts, territories, states, whatever you want to call it. And so they always make that presumption. But I found something that I think everybody's going to be, it shocked me, and I think it's going to shock everybody listening. Here's another one from U.S. versus Anthony, 24 Fed 829 from 1873. Emphasis added, the term resident and citizen of the United States is distinguished from a citizen of one of the several states in that the former is a special class of citizen created by Congress. Again, that was the 39th Congress that created a citizen of the United States, or what they commonly refer to as a United States citizen. Okay, So, like I said, I had to go all the way back to 1802. So when this lady, Elkian, from Russia that got naturalized, when I realized how indoctrinated she was into the belief that because she got naturalized, she had to be a U.S. citizen because she took an oath to that effect, I realized that that she didn't understand what the truth was. How can you be something that was made up? If you're a living, breathing soul, how can you be anything that Congress makes up? So that's the overview of it. That's the 40,000-foot view. We're about to get down to the bare knuckles of the matter. So I looked at the Act of Congress dated April 14th, 82, and here's the stat. It's it's from the statutes at large. To become a U.S. citizen, it's located at 2 Stat 153, Clause 28, Section 1. Which was only revised one time with a revised statute, section 2165. And I had to go all the way back, but what the act says, and it provides that, quote, an alien may be admitted to become a citizen of the United States in the following manner, comma, and not otherwise. And that's where the evil is, right there at the end. And not otherwise. What does "and not otherwise" mean? And not otherwise means unless you become a United States citizen in the following manner, you're not a United States citizen. And not otherwise includes things like a voter registration that you signed under penalty of perjury that you were a U.S. citizen. That doesn't make you a U.S. citizen because it's not one of the three things that's needed to become a U.S. citizen. A driver's license, which the commercial courts consider a contract, that doesn't make you a U.S. citizen. A registered birth certificate does not make you a U.S. citizen. A Social Security number assigned to you does not make you a U.S. citizen. All of these things that they use to make the presumption that you are a U.S. citizen, they're not what's required by law to become a U.S. citizen. So I found a case in 1893 called City of Minneapolis versus Reum, and that is R-E-U-M. It was from the Circuit Court of Appeals from the Eighth Circuit, and it's dated May 29, 1893. Again, that's City of Minneapolis versus Reum from 1893, R-E-U-M. And so sticking with that last part of the sentence of what's required to become a U.S. citizen and not otherwise, I'm going to talk to you about something. I'm going to open your eyes wide. According to this case law, if you read it, and I have already sent copies to the other speakers here tonight, there are three things needed to become a U.S. citizen. Now, it's important to note that it's got to be all three things. It's not one of the three things. All three things have to occur before you can call yourself a U.S. citizen. First, the process was clearly stated as conclusion of law by this court, the Eighth Circuit. The court went on to state three factors whereby you needed to comply to become a U.S. citizen and not otherwise. They are, quoting the court and quoting the decision of the case that I just gave you. First, he shall, 2 years at least prior to his admission, declare before a proper court his intention to become a citizen of the United States. In the case, Mr. Reum did this, and to renounce his allegiance to the potentate or sovereignty of which he may be at that time a citizen or subject. Mr. Reum did not do this, and if you look at the Naturalization Act, I think it's of 1779, it's either 72 or 70, I think it's 79, 1779, Mr. Reum did not do this, and neither does anyone else that uses the Naturalization Act in court to swear an oath to become a U.S. citizen. That's number one. Here's number two. He shall, at the time of his application to be admitted, declare on oath before some one of the courts above specified that he will support the Constitution of the United States and that he absolutely and entirely renounces and abjures all allegiance and fidelity to every foreign prince, potentate, state, pay attention, state or sovereignty, and particularly by name, which is what Harold was talking about a little while ago, by name, to the prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty of which he was before a citizen or subject, comma, here's the big part, which proceeding shall be recorded by the clerk of the court. So what is that saying? You have to go into a court. There has to be an official proceeding. You have to swear an oath to become a citizen of the United States. Here's the third thing, and this is goes in line with what David was saying about the difference between a man and a person, a man created by God and a person. It shall be made to appear to the satisfaction of the court admitting such alien that he has resided within the United States 5 years at least, and within the state or territory where such court is at the time held 1 year at least, and that during that time he has behaved as a man, capital letters, M-A-N, of a good moral character, attached to the principles of the Constitution of the United States, and well disposed to the good order and happiness of the same. But that oath of the applicant shall in no case be allowed to prove his residence. The inference here is the word man, located in the third item. So all three things have to occur for you to become legally or lawfully a U.S. citizen. This statute was only amended once, like I said. It was amended in May, an act of May 26, 1824, 4-69, clause 186, section 1, Revised Statute, Section 2167, and all it did was it removed the two-year limit in Item 1, which was Section 2165 of 2 Stat 153, Clause 28, Section 1. The term of their legal law for man is non-resident alien. That's right, folks. You're all non-resident aliens if you didn't do those three items in a court of law where a clerk of the court filed a transcript. You can't be a U.S. citizen. No such thing exists. Even the people that got naturalized didn't do all three things, so none of them are U.S. citizens either. And I had told Dave and Daniel and John earlier that the reason I always knew that they could never prove jurisdiction in court and that they could never prove it on the record, but I wasn't exactly sure why until I saw that and not otherwise. And then it all hit me like a ton of bricks. Nobody does these three things. Nobody's a U.S. citizen, and statutes are only a U.S. citizen is the only – a U.S. citizen and a federal employee are the only two things subject to the statutes of a state. It's like I always told everybody on the call, there's only two laws in our country. There's the state constitution and the federal constitution. And everything else is a statute, rule, regulation, ordinance, or some other thing that we can all ignore unless we took an oath in front of a court and the clerk of the court made a transcript of the oath of the procession in court, and it was entered on the record, okay, in some court somewhere. Nobody listening to this call has ever done that. Even the people that were naturalized that came from different countries never did these three things. There is a man is a non-resident alien according to the Title 26. I followed this up with John because he said the definition in Title 26 for an individual is either a resident or non-resident alien. Okay? But the statutes, the other statutes outside of Title 26 are only concerning U.S. citizen subjects. Okay, they make you your subject. They did this on purpose about this non-resident alien using the word alien, and think about this. This makes logical sense. A man, the term of their law for man is non-resident alien. This is correct, but they used this term knowing everyone would say, I ain't no alien.
thereby negating the very thing that would set them free. The maxim of law that I looked up for this is this, expressio unius est exclusio alterius. Are all statutes either comprising of man or person? Well, anybody that knows anything about the law knows that it's got to be a person. Man is devoid of statute. Non-resident alien, a.k.a. man, is mentioned and excluded in statute because he is the term non-resident alien, meaning not resident of any contract. Therefore, alien to the Constitution, policy, regulations, etc. Okay, how did I tie all this in? I went to 1864, where I found Whiting, who was the Solicitor General in that year, the Solicitor General of the country. And this is what he said. An alien owes no allegiance or obedience to our government or to our Constitution, laws, or proclamations. A citizen subject is bound to obey them all. A United States citizen is bound to obey them all. In refusing such obedience, he is guilty of crime against his country and finds in the law of nations no justification for his disobedience. An alien, being under no such obligation, is justified in refusing such obedience. Over an alien enemy, our government can make no constitution, law, or proclamation of obligatory force, because our laws bind only our own subjects and have no extraterritorial jurisdiction. Folks, when I get done, none of you are going to ever refer to yourselves as a citizen again. Over citizens who are subject to this government, he goes on to say, over citizens who are subjects of this government, even if they have so far repudiated their duties as to become enemies, our constitutions, statutes, and proclamations are the supreme law of the land. The fact that their enforcement is resisted does not make them void. It is not in the power of armed subjects of the Union to repeal or legally nullify our Constitution, laws, and other governmental acts. The source for that quote came from the Legal Classics Library, War Powers, under the Constitution of the United States, 1864, 10th edition, entered by Act of Congress in the Clerk's Office of the District Court of the District of Massachusetts, Special Edition, in 1997. I want to remind everybody that I had spoke before about Congressional Treaty 95-20, and this was a treaty with the United Nations, and in that treaty, under Article 1, it says, all peoples have the right to self-determination. Well, if you're not a U.S. citizen and the statutes don't apply to you, then where they define the term person in the statutes does not apply to you either. So now you're a people. Persons is plural. People is singular. It means one thing, where persons mean many different things. Or person. The word person means several different things. Some alive, some dead, all made up. All fictions of law under color of law. And I'm just going to go through a little history on this because I really nailed this down. Remember, we were subjects before the 1776 war. We lost and became citizen subjects after the 1783 peace treaty, where the king dictated to the United States exactly what he wanted, thereby leaving his subjects to become his subjects, now known as citizens of the Vatican's corporations. Do not forget that the treaty of April 21st, 1214, where the king turned his entire kingdom and subjects over to the Pope/Vatican Corporation. You are now under ecclesiastical law of the Vatican since 1787, which I confirmed with David Horowitz earlier when we spoke. The books showing that the Vatican rules every aspect of your movements and daily lives. He created the IRS in 1861, and our parents never knew it. Our great-grandparents never knew it. The Social Security number, by the way, is only to give you an enemy ID so that you may deal in banking. That's all the Social Security number is. It was not for Social Security. The two corporate cases settled by the corporate Supreme Court came right out in 1935 and said there never was a Social Security. It was all a fraud, and it was admitted in 1953, of which there was a document posted 2 years before this legal researcher's website called ATG Press was shut down by powers that you or I don't even know exist, but they do. If anybody's ever listened to Jesse Ventura and how they shut him up on Google, on his Google Talks, I think he's got one out there called 100 Documents Every American Should Know About. But if you listen to what they did to him, then you'll understand what I'm talking about now. Going back to the Erie Railroad case of 1892, Justice Field, dissenting, said, "The government thus lays a tax through the instrumentality of the company upon the income of a non-resident alien over whom it cannot justly exercise any control, nor upon whom it can justly lay any burden. The power of the United States is to tax, or to tax is limited to persons, property, and business within their jurisdiction, as much as that of the state is limited to the same subjects within its jurisdiction." And that's quoted from United States versus Erie Railway Company, spelled E-R-I-E, 106 U.S. 327. So these courts that we just might find ourselves in today have to produce to you and I and everyone else these three facts of evidence stated by the court above. Remember earlier I said we were trying to prove we weren't U.S. citizens instead of making them prove that we were. And we have every right to do that. Number one, three facts of evidence: that you absolutely and entirely renounced and abjured all allegiance and fidelity to God your Creator. That's the first thing they have to prove. Number two, and had given your intentions to the court to become a U.S. citizen subject of a corporate nature in writing. There are no other provisions of the acts of Congress under which you could have been naturalized. The court did state, and not otherwise. And number three, since the statute at large, not code, says it's recorded in fact too. So here's what happens. Either the court has to provide you these three facts of evidence, or you win hands down with the plaintiff cannot produce this fact evidence to you and the court. The court is the only one that has it, not the RICO agent coming after you. And that's what I call them. I call all state agencies RICO agents. That's why they have to work from presumption. So the reason they can never prove jurisdiction on the record is because they all know that there's no such thing as a U.S. citizen. If you don't believe that by now, you're never going to believe it. And to finish this up, in the Eighth Circuit, Judge Levy then went on to quote another case called Assessors versus Osborne, and that's from 9 Wall 76, U.S. 567 at 574. I'll repeat that. Assessors, A-S-S-E-S-S-O-R-S, versus Osborne, O-S-B-O-R-N-E, 9 Wall 76, U.S. 567 at 574. This is what he said. This is a direct quote, folks, because a lot of people have federal court issues. This is what he said. District courts are courts of special jurisdiction, and therefore they cannot take jurisdiction of any case, either civil or criminal. That's huge right there, either civil or criminal, where they are not authorized to do so by an act of Congress. That goes back with the case law I was reading to you guys earlier. He also directly quoted this. This is a leading case and has not been distinguished, modified, or overruled, and the emphasis was his. Now, let me tell you where the evil is here. In 1988, Congress eliminated the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court to review decisions on appeal from state courts and decisions of the United States Court of Appeals. That's not a Republican form of government, folks, and there's definitely not a separation of powers doctrine in force if that be the case. And it is. I checked it out. What we have is a commissioner form of corporate government, what they call a democracy, operating through corporate administrative agencies and commercial tribunals, otherwise known as corporations. But these tribunals are courts of special or limited jurisdiction. the guy that wrote this legal research that I'm referring to right now said at the end, I know this is true as I was the first case from a state case on appeal that was denied. They denied his appeal because they couldn't prove he was a U.S. citizen. And they can't prove it against you either. Also, when I put this together, I also did an Excel spreadsheet where I gave the term person as it's defined by statute in all 50 states. Again, I think Daniel has a copy of that. If he doesn't, David does. And basically, that's the big reveal for me tonight. So does anyone have any questions about whether you're a U.S. citizen or not, or any other comments? I yield the floor.
I have a couple of things.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
One thing, and I agree with you, Ed, but one good case to look up is United States v. Wong space K-I-M, Kim space A-R-K period. And that just goes to show, now this guy was trying to prove he was a U.S. citizen, and then you'll see the other way that the court will go, which goes back to what you're saying about presumptions. And that was March 28th of 1898.
March 28th, 1898.
Yep.
And you United said U.S. States. Versus Wong Kim.
Yep, W-O-N-G space K-I-M space A-R-K period.
A-R-K
and there they go into stating how somebody is a U.S. citizen when he wants to be one. So
you said that was 1898? An 1898 case?
Yep, March 28th, 1898.
Okay, continue. Thank you. One I missed.
And the other thing I just wanted to say is you commented the Erie Railroad case. I think you said
yes.
It was an 1800s case. I believe it was 1938. And to me, that's... It's not a big deal, but it goes back to the Banking Act and money system. It was decided, after the Emergency Banking Act, but that was all.
Yep, now,
that's it.
Now, not Erie versus Tompkins. I'm not talking about Erie versus Tompkins. Are you sure you're talking about Erie Railroad?
No, you're correct. I misunderstood. That's the one I was referring to. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's all right. Listen, man, I am nuts. Anybody that knows me knows I am nuts about tracking down the truth, and I'm pretty sure I got all this right. But the point being that all of this okay, so right now my partners, my silent partners and my regular partners, everybody knows who it is, Chris, up in New York, Child Support Made Simple. We're currently putting see, our problem is we're having to write a slew of motions and demands and notices for these child support enforcement cases. And then when we do that, they came to a point 6 months ago when they realized they couldn't answer our motion to dismiss, and they just started bypassing our paperwork, and then we had to start writing out four or five rebuttals. We can't take a new case until after January 31st, the way it sits right now. So the point being, I want to bypass all that paperwork, and we want to put a motion in up front saying, hey, first prove on the record that I'm a U.S. citizen, and then we'll talk about jurisdiction. And that's currently what we're doing right now. We're putting in a demand, whether you want to call it a motion, a request, a demand, or a notice, it makes no difference. Whatever we call it, that's what we're going to call it, and we're going to say, first, you need to prove that I'm a U.S. citizen and that the statutes you charged me with apply to me. And they have to prove it because I've got this case, this Freedom case, that says they do. And they have to present all three facts of evidence. And I'm telling you right now, nobody on this call, nobody in your state, and nobody in the nation has ever completed these three items. In one way or another, to be a U.S. citizen, first you have to be an alien. Think about it. If you're not a U.S. citizen, what are you? If you're a man, you're a non-resident alien according to the legal statutes. A man cannot be a U.S. citizen. and a man cannot be a person as defined by statute because statutes don't apply to anyone other than U.S. citizens.
I agree.
Anybody
with
else?
You.
All right.
Can I jump in on that point?
Sure. Just go ahead.
Yeah, I want to piggy bank off of what he was saying about how man is not recognized in the statutes, which is quite true. There is about 129 references between state and federal statutes that mention man, but it categorizes it as an animal, man or other animal, man or other animal. So an animal is not a man created by God, and man is not recognized in the statutes if he's a non-resident alien. He cannot be a man or a U.S. citizen. So that all ties in together under the statutory scheme of not recognizing man as created by the creator of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he's dead on point on that one. That's great. This is a little ticky-tack, but I hear a lot of people make this mistake of utilizing H.R. 192 as authority. The authority is actually Chapter 48, 48 Stat 112. That's the official citation once that resolution became an act. So if you're using H.R. 192, and especially with people that know, they would say, oh, this person don't know what they're talking about because they're using a resolution instead of the stat or the act. And it's also under, I think it's Public Law 7810, if I'm not mistaken.
73.
But 73. Okay, thank you. And the last point that I want to mention is to also to piggyback off of what he was saying about returning the mail. You got to be careful not to use the two-letter so-called designation of a state as well as the zip, because both or one or the other will put you in the federal zone. So you spell out the state. Don't use the two-letter designation.
Thank you. He's absolutely correct. I didn't mention that, but yes, you have to spell out. So everything's spelled out. In my case, Georgia, with no zip code. That's the way I get my mail. And if they don't spell it Georgia and they spell it GA and they put the zip code in for my address, I send it back with that notice, return to sender. Thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah. Yeah, but everything else, I'm dead on point with you.
So
very good presentation.
Thank you. Do you see the
I have a question.
It has to be recorded by a clerk of a court somewhere, so they have to have evidence of it. If they can't produce the evidence, I'm not a U.S. citizen. Simple as that. Go ahead.
And the way I do that also, what gets the same result, is I proffered it as a negative averment, that I have no proof, seen no proof, to make me a U.S. citizen. Now the onus is on them to prove that I am.
Right.
And that's worked for me.
When my partners and I get done with this this notice, motion, demand, whatever we end up calling it, when we get done with it and I've got all this in one document, I'm going to make sure that all of Daniel's callers get it. There's some callers on here right now that I know that need it, and they're going to get it as well. But I think this will bypass all the other paper, even my demand of particulars, my bill of particulars. I don't have to put that into a case anymore. I don't have to put it in as an exhibit. I don't have to do any of that. I just have to make them prove that I'm a U.S. citizen and that the statutes that they're charging me with apply to me as a man. And if they can't do that, then they're going to have a tough road to, like I said, we'll own them. We'll own them if they can't move forward either. So anyway, that was my thought process. That's my partner's thought process. It hit me like a ton of bricks, though, guys and girls, when I read it over and over again, and not otherwise. They're presuming you're a U.S. citizen by all of this supposition paperwork that they create for us. I'll give you one example. It's mandated by state statute that we all must carry a driver's license if we want to operate a motor vehicle on the public highways in the state. So anything that's not voluntary or done knowingly and intelligently is not a valid waiver of my rights, according to Johnson versus Zerbst. That's Z-E-R-B-S-T. So unless I waive my rights knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, I didn't waive them. And so that's what I'm operating on, and that's they're operating. All of this is corporate fraud, folks. I read an article from this same legal researcher where he had every single vote for Title 26, and he came to the conclusion that there was never an up and down vote to create the IRS. I think the congressmen and senators were afraid they were going to get hung because the IRS is not a government entity, just like the Federal Reserve Bank is not a government entity. They have nothing to do with government. They're private corporations.
Yeah, the IRS was created. The IRS was created off the back of the Federal Reserve system to collect taxes for the debt. After they saw that tariffs wasn't
right, which are actually gifts. If you go down into the Title 26, it's actually a gift.
Yep.
This is John.
Everything you pay, everything you pay them. Go ahead, John.
The IRS was never done by any congressional act. What it was the Office of the Commissioner was created, and there was a little blurb in there that said that he had the authority to hire helpers. And the IRS admits that in some of their own statements. And when you look at the organizational chart under the Treasury, you'll see that the IRS is down there. It's way down at the bottom, kind of an offshoot of something. But they weren't. The IRS agency itself never was actually created by Congress. It was only Office of the Commissioner. I yield.
Yeah, John, thank you for that. I appreciate that as a redirect towards that. Ed, I wanted to make a comment, and I believe there was a caller that wanted to ask a question. So if that caller would just hold on a second while I make this comment and then come back on, we'll do this and get you in there in queue. I wanted to make a direct understanding here. This U.S. citizen question, I've been around and around and around, of course, like you all on this. And I just want to make this one clear, concise statement. You are not, never were, never can be in the current state of affairs a U.S. citizen. However, the person of the organizational name that was created at an event that you have a certificate, if you have such a certificate, is. I just want to make that perfectly clear that person is created by act of Congress, given citizenship, and if you decide to act in agency for that person, although you are not a U.S. citizen, you need to look at the law of agency to comprehend that agency attaches and responsibility attaches to the agent. So just keeping that in mind, and what we're talking about here is keeping the boot up our neck. Remember the mission statement, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burden, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. In the scriptures, that's why in the book of Job, that we're not to be enticed with these flattering titles of men. So there was another question out there. That's all I wanted to do is a redirect as far as citizenship issues are concerned. Who is that caller that was asking to interject a question?
Your neighbor, Scott.
Go ahead.
I have a question. this is related to the topic of man versus person versus animal and all that stuff. And this applies to something that's close to home regarding our group. Does a man prevail in a Title 42 1983 action, or is it the person? And I yield.
Person.
I'm sorry. Somebody was speaking to me when he asked his question. Could you repeat the question for me? Does man?
The question is, does the man prevail in the Title 42 1983 action, or does the person prevail?
Well, see, that's the beauty of it. It doesn't matter whether you're a person or a man, whether you're an alien or a U.S. citizen. You both have the same rights to bring a 1983 claim into court. Some use the 14th Amendment, some use the 4th Amendment and the 5th Amendment, some use the 6th Amendment. But all 14th Amendment citizens have a right for redress of grievance if they believe that their rights have been violated in any state court. So in answer to your question, both equally apply. We just don't ever want to be termed or deemed a U.S. citizen. That's what I'm telling you. If you're a U.S. citizen, this corrupt corporate government that we're dealing with and that we can't seem to straighten up or change is deeming it, presuming us all to be U.S. citizens so that we remain their subjects. My point to everybody here tonight is we can't be a U.S. citizen. And if I can't be a U.S. citizen, then the term person that's defined by statute can't apply to me. Even though it's a real thing, I'm not acting as the agent for the I'm not acting as an agent for that specific purpose. I'm acting on my own behalf, and they have to listen to me. Whether they're always going to deem you as a person, always, no matter what you do. My point is they can't come against you in a civil or criminal case that they allege if they can't prove that you're a U.S. citizen, and that's what I'm trying to stop. I'm trying to stop these corrupt corporate courts that are actually, in my opinion, in one man's opinion, more corrupt than the other two branches combined. And with that, I yield. I hope I answered your question.
Well, and I agree, but when we're talking about a Title 42, 1983, we are on offense. We're the plaintiffs, so therefore, are we placing ourselves in a precarious position by leaning on this 14th Amendment citizen protection? And I yield.
Okay, the answer to that question is no. If you were born, so look at it this way. If I was born in a state, territory, municipality, province, jurisdiction, limited jurisdiction, special jurisdiction, if I am not a U.S. citizen, and I just showed you I can't be a U.S. citizen, then what happens is I was born not in the de facto United States. I was born in the de jure government with a capital T, the United States of America. I was born inside the Republic. I was born on land and soil. They make the transition when they presume that because you were born within their territory that you are a U.S. citizen, but you can't be because you didn't go into a court and you didn't swear to it on a record that was made by the clerk of the court, and they can't produce the transcript. So you can't be a U.S. citizen. It's a fiction. It's a color of law. It's a fiction, a legal fiction under color of law. Now, we're talking about agency. We also spoke about this earlier. Whenever I go into court, and everybody on here knows I've got a lot of experience with that over the past 8 or so years, they always refer to me as a pro se, no matter how many times I say that I'm appearing in propria persona sui juris. Every document I get from them says that they refer to me as a pro se, which means I'm representing something.
Impropria persona means I'm presenting myself to the court sui juris with all my rights intact. So, but they and I've even asked judges in open court, why do you keep referring to me as a pro se? I'm not representing anything or anybody in this courtroom. I'm presenting myself to the court. Why do you insist? The law has to be precise, Your Honor. Are you trying? Is this some type of fraud that you're perpetrating against me by demanding to call me a pro se litigant? So I hope that answers your question. I can't be a pro se. I can't be a U.S. citizen. The word person is defined in as long as I don't come off that square. Produce for me the proof, those three items of evidence that you need to prove that I'm a U.S. citizen, and then we can start discussing your lack of jurisdiction. But until you first prove that I'm a U.S. citizen, statutes don't apply to me. You're never going to hear a sovereign citizen make that argument in court, because a sovereign citizen, my definition of a sovereign citizen is a term that they made up in the FBI. They know something's definitely wrong. They just don't know the law. Right here, what I'm sharing with you guys tonight is the actual law from 1802 that's never been changed since 1779, the Naturalization Act. I don't abjure any other type of potency or king or state or sovereignty when I get naturalized as a U.S. citizen. If we're born here, we don't have to go through naturalization. So there's the crux of the argument right there. If I don't have to go through the Naturalization Act and you're just presuming I'm a U.S. citizen because I got a birth certificate and a Social Security number and a driver's license, well, I got some bad news for you. That's not what's required to be a U.S. citizen. So either prove it by the court transcript that I'm a U.S. citizen. I took an oath in front of a competent court in a limited jurisdiction or special jurisdiction or whatever jurisdiction in any state that I gave an oath to be a U.S. citizen, and I will write the check. Otherwise, you don't have a case, and the statutes you alleged against me don't apply to me, because I've got to be considered by you to be a non-resident alien, but I cannot be a U.S. citizen. And with that, I yield.
Well, thank you for that, Ed. I want to encourage everybody when it comes to these topics that what Ed's talking about, in my opinion, is expounding on the very thing of special appearance that we read earlier. He's talking about not entering into the merits of the case. He's not talking. He's not arguing whether he did or did not do whatever they're claiming he did or did not do. He's getting down to one issue. When he looked at it, this iceberg he's standing on, and even though the waves might be tumultuous around him, he's going to stand on that one piece of evidentiary lack of evidence that is not on the record, and he's not going to let it go. I wanted to say this, that what's been occurring to me when we look at these subjects is you've all heard the phrase, my word is my bond. Well, I want you to consider that when you go into a court, into a county with those that count, and you go into a court, and maybe you're going to into a debt, potentially a debtor's court. When you go there, you've heard my word is my bond. Why would you give your bond to those people? Why would you give energy? Why would you apply any of your word or your bond to that arena? When you come in there and you give them that energy, when you give them your coin, your word, your very valuable substance, you are submitting yourself in a general appearance, and you are waiving your right to challenge their presumptions. And that's basically what I'm hearing, and I'm basically trying to streamline it down to take all of these words from all of these readings and all the things that we heard from the testimony of Harold and John and Ed and Dave and myself so far on this call and reduce it down so that we at least have the principle of the matter. With that being said, I have one more thing I want you to iterate, Ed, if you feel so inclined, that there are people on this call tonight that may want to take advantage of the trial and error on relation to the Mucchini case with the District Court of the United States and such like. If you feel like you want to share that out for people to attempt
to give that a trial and error and come back and give us a report, if you feel such is timely. I didn't talk about you. I'm putting you on the spot, so we can
okay.
We can defray that. If you...
What case?
No, I'm talking about we talked about earlier today, and I'm putting you on the spot. You can say you don't feel good about talking about it, and I'm okay with that, and everyone will just wonder what in the world we're talking about. But we're talking about
okay.
the miscellaneous case.
A miscellaneous case. The miscellaneous
yeah.
case. I'm trying to remember.
Federal miscellaneous case, Ed.
Oh, yeah.
Filing.
Yeah, okay, yes. Yeah. So how you file a federal case if you want an Article III court? We could do a whole topic on this, and I really, because I can't find any research about it, I just learned it from one of those smartest guys in the room types. Whenever you file a complaint or anything else in, or make a federal case, okay, as the plaintiff, when you go to the clerk of the court, this is how you file. You tell the clerk of the court, I want to file this complaint under miscellaneous in the green file, G-R-E-E-N. That automatically puts you into an Article III court. You can't find it anywhere, but I learned it from a guy named Ron Kelly in California who's the Chief Justice of Orange County for the Republic of the California State Assembly, which is comprised of a bunch of American state nationals. Okay? They follow someone called Anna Von Reitz, and this guy when he got tested, he had an IQ of 350. But he's the one that found the fraud. And I know he was off the charts. He's also the one that found the fraud in the mortgage banking system. So all mortgages are fraud, and he's got a flow chart that shows that all the money that you sign your name to for a loan is created out of thin air, and it ends up in the superior court of your county, whatever county you reside in. It all goes back to the court, which explains to me why every year without fail, and everybody can look this up, 38.3% of the federal government's budget comes from the judicial branch of our government. Everybody needs to really think about what that means. 40%, almost 40% of the entire federal budget comes from the judiciary, the judicial branch of our government. The rest of it comes from taxes made by the legislative government. And the mandates, I would argue, on this day, I would argue the mandates being imposed by the legislative and administrative branches. So, and don't forget about that fourth branch of government, the trial by jury. The jurors in the jury box, I call them the fourth branch of government. But they can't be your peers because they all claim that they're U.S. citizens, whereas nobody on this call tonight could ever claim that again. I use state citizen of one of the several states in all of my bulletproof paperwork that anybody's got a copy of. I have always used that term in the 8 years that I fought in criminal cases. I use that term. I'm a state citizen of one of the several states. I don't want to be any kind of citizen after what I share with you tonight because of the words and not otherwise. They can't use any presumption. They have to prove it. If they can't prove it, they don't have a case. And they not only do they have to prove it to me, they also have to prove it to the court. And so I'm telling you right now, this is why they can never put proof of jurisdiction into the record of one of these corporate cases, because they don't have it. They know that we're not U.S. citizens. This was all made up. It started with the 39th Congress. So remember, if you're filing a complaint, a 1983 action in a federal district court, you're going to file it under miscellaneous in the green file. I know this works for a fact. I've got a lady that I'm working with down in Tifton, Georgia, where they're trying to take her home. She filed her case last Friday in federal district court 7 minutes before they closed. She told the clerk, I want to file this in the thing I noticed about these green files, and the one I know for a fact that I shared with the guys earlier, these numbers are really low. Like hers was like 421 signifying the date of the year. MC-411, MC-411. The one that I shared with the guys earlier, which is a Ron Kelly case, the guy that told me about this, he said 2:12 MC-26 was the number on his case. Not many people know about this, folks. Not many people know this, but I'm sharing it with the group. While I'm sharing that, I learned something else spectacular. This guy actually studied the Bible. And since we're on the House of Prayer, I'm going to mention this because he told me, and he said, I said, how sure are you about this fact? He said, I am positive. And this guy, when I say he studied the Bible, I'm saying he wanted to know if the second coming could be predicted, which obviously God says it can't. The day or the hour can't be predicted. But this is what he told me. The Jewish calendar, and we spoke about this in September of 2021. So he said the actual Jewish calendar, the actual date is 5995. He said this is the true number. He said in 6 more years on Yom Kippur, which was October 4th and 5th, will be the second coming. And if anybody's adding that up, that would be the year 2027 on October 4th or the 5th. So I suggest if you ain't living right, you ain't got much time left if Ron Kelly's correct about that. I don't know it for a fact, but I'm passing it on to you. I said, how in the world did you arrive at 5995? And he went into detail about what he did, how he went through the Old Testament, and he had to add some years and subtract some years, like during the times of Noah, times regarding Israel. He said you have to add in one chapter and subtract in the next. He told me that he could absolutely prove that men lived at least 900 years back in the Old Testament. I mean, you think about that. We're definitely not eating right or something. I know it's sin that's killing us off earlier and earlier, but anyway, he was, all I can tell you is, because this is not my research, but all I can tell you is about this, is that this guy was a CPA. He turned down a $6 million a year job when he proved to his bosses that in the mortgage banking industry, everything they did was fraud. He turned down $6 million a year in income and walked away from it. So this guy is a true patriot, you know, as far as I'm concerned. Now, is he good at math? I don't know, but he tells me that the 6,000 years is right around the corner. So with that, which might even be better than what I said about the U.S. citizen, I will yield, especially if it's true. I yield.
I got a comment about that being the moderator of the House of Prayer. I want to say that I studied with Gustav Hoyer, who was a fourth-generation etymologist, and he finished up Ivan Panin's work called Bible Chronology, and he also was fully aware of discrepancies in dates. And although I'm not espousing any futurism as those of you that know me in that respect, I want to say that every day is a good day to get your life right with God. And if you're not living right, I don't recommend you wait until 2027, because not a caller on this phone line tonight can guarantee their morrow. So that's one comment. And so very good encouragement. Thank you for encouraging us to pent and then repent. Now, I want to make you aware.
One more comment about that. My philosophy in life, Daniel, is this. If you're not living right, you're living wrong. If you know you're living wrong, you have no guarantee of salvation. If you're not living in the service of others, you're not doing what God instructed us to do. So that's my comment about the difference between living right and living wrong. We're supposed to give up all of our wants, and it's a much easier to do that if you think of it from the standpoint that I do, which is, the years that we live on this earth is but a glimpse, just a tiny fraction of sand in a desert full of sand compared to eternity. So if you look at it from that standpoint, it's much easier for me to live right and for me to live in the service of others. And with that, I'll yield.
All right. Thank you, Ed, for that. And for those of us like myself who have been a preacher all my life, it's life is but a vapor, which appeareth for a moment and then vanisheth. So the same construct. I wanted to bring one of my teachers from the past, whom I haven't heard from in many years, and he was getting up there in age, and don't know that he is going to be equivalent to Methuselah, and don't know if he's still amongst us. But I learned, and some of you may know, Eric, who are you? And I've got incredible video presentations because I came and interviewed him many years ago, and quite a man who walked out of an IRS charge hearing in 5 minutes' time, and they told him they'd be getting back to him, and he hadn't heard from them in all those years. We can talk about that some other time, but I borrowed this on the subject of citizenship, and so blessed, and I actually had it on mute, and I hooted and hollered when you said that you're giving up the word citizen, Ed. I was really blessed for that determination on your part. Eric, one of the things I learned from Eric, he said, when did I knowingly, willingly, intentionally, with full disclosure of all the negative consequences thereof, ever agree to be a citizen of anything? And that was one of the Eric, who are you quips I borrowed from him. When did I knowingly, willingly, intentionally, voluntarily, with full disclosure of all the negative consequences thereof, agree to be a citizen of your society? With that, I'm going to open it up again and see if there's anybody else out there that feels like they have got to jump in. I know that John's been particularly quiet tonight, and see where this call is going.
Well, this is John. And one of the things I want to say is when you boil down to Ed's position on the U.S. citizen, and that pretty much everybody else is in this call, is it boils down to the word presumption. The courts and the government and everybody we deal with makes the presumption that we're a U.S. citizen. And our goal is to refute that presumption. And as Ed has talked about, a presumption is something that a judge or an agency or an agent or whoever you're dealing with, they may be consciously making the presumption or unconsciously making the presumption based on some training they had that had a condition proceeding in it. So when we look at a presumption in a court setting stands as the, unless there's something contrary presented, a presumption will work itself into a presumed fact. And then that presumed fact, unless it's rebutted or there's some other kind of evidence comes in, works itself into a legal undisputed fact. And that's how people lose court cases. They don't rebut presumptions. And so what happens now with this information about U.S. citizen, we will be able to stand up and flat-footedly rebut the presumption of U.S. citizen. Now, what a lot of people don't know is the presumption of citizen can also go with a signature. And they've left us an out in Title 28 for signing outside of the United States. If we give an unrestricted signature, then that signature is presumed to be in the United States. Now, everybody knows about my position on money and stuff like that. But one of the things that I did was I made up what I call a conditional promise. And so the way I start that conditional promise, it says in the title, in the heading of the thing, this is the total heading, without prejudice, non-territorial to the United States as used in 28 U.S.C. 1746, parentheses 1. And then right above the signature, it says the same thing. Now, when I put this little document into the court, it cost somebody $100,000. It wasn't me, okay? And it saved me $100,000. But I think the key thing is moving your citizens out of the United States when you deal
with the court. So they can't make the presumption, because I go in and I say that I'm a non-corporate, flesh and blood human being possessing all legal rights and without prejudice, do tender this offer, blah, blah, blah. And that, you know, I won't go into the rest of it. But anyway, that statement was made outside the territory of the United States. And there's no way they can prove that it was made in the United States. And when I put this into a document where the courts wanted $100,000, I put this in there, and all of a sudden they didn't have anything else to say. So bear in mind that your signature also carries a presumption with it. So I yield.
Okay, this is open forum tonight, and with everybody is doing really good, not to step on anybody's toes. Anybody else got a comment, question?
Yes, I have a comment on the last caller's comment. With regards to the signature, that is a very, very big issue that people do not give enough credence to. Between the name and the signature, if you acquiesce to it, you're making yourself the name, and the name is being you. That's why you hear me say one called or one known as Harold Ellis, because I am not a name, and the name is not me. And when you sign, especially without restriction or an unrestricted signature, you're basically putting yourself in suretyship, in joinder, with the principal, which is the all cap. So, yes, he is very much correct about the signature putting you into, or could be putting you into, their so-called presumed United States citizenship. So, yes, be careful with the signature. Make sure that it is not unrestricted, but restricted. And do not... Well, this is my recommendation. Do not equate yourself with the name. I have a mantra. I am not the name. I am not a name. And a name is not me. What's on paper or on a computer screen is not me. I am who I am in this vessel called a man. But I'm not that which is on paper. That's why, what is one of the first things that they ask you in court? Either they ask you your name or ask you to state your name for the record. That is so crucial and necessary for attachment to the court. Without that, the court cannot proceed. Now, how Ed does it, his way with the citizenship challenge, which I like greatly, but I stop them with just the name, because nothing in commerce cannot proceed without acquiescence or acknowledgement of the name. Because once you have acknowledgement of the name, you have acknowledgement of liability. So I just wanted to add a piggy bank on, who was that, Dave? The last caller who spoke.
Don.
Don, okay. Yeah, I just want to piggy bank off of that, because that is absolutely essential and crucial, especially when we consider what Ed brought to the table tonight. I yield.
I like to use a question. You know, if somebody's, especially a policeman, or, you know, you get in there and they say, "What's your name?" Well, if you don't know who I am, what are you talking to me for? You should already know my name. So when they come at you and they start asking all these questions, I usually answer them with some kind of question. That's and the name, like when they drag you in court, say, "Well, state your name." Say, "Well, if you don't know who I am, what am I doing here?" So, of course, I'm a smart ass anyway. I yield.
Well, that's a good response. Because, you know, a name in commerce is attached to a thing. Are you a thing or are you a man? You know, as men and women, We don't have names. We have appellations, but not names. We have titles, but not names. Name is commerce. Name is attached to a thing or a label of a thing. So, and we're in these commercial contract courts. So they look for names. They're looking at you as a thing, man or another animal. They're not looking at you as a man created by God or a woman created by God. They're looking to you as the suretyship for the principle that you're enjoying. And that's something that Daniel brought out that was very poignant with regards to the citizenship, is how you act with that person. If you're enjoying there, then they can come to you as surety or the accommodating party for the liability. So you have to be careful how you utilize that. If you're unsure, always make yourself a beneficiary, because as a beneficiary, you're not in a position of a trustee. So, you know, Daniel made a very, very good point that even if you cannot be a U.S. citizen based on what Ed brought to the table, you still could be liable if you're acting in joinder with the entity, using unrestricted signatures and the like could cause problems, even if you're not a U.S. citizen. So I thought that was a very good point that Daniel brought up. I yield.
That I believe you're speaking to basically the law of agency in that sense, where you can be held liable as an agent if the principal is not identified.
There you go.
Yeah, and that's interesting. We talked about this many months ago about the undisclosed principal. Isn't that interesting that the principal is never disclosed in these proceedings? We really have you remember, I believe it's Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 17 B, if I'm not mistaken, where the real party of interest can come to proceeding. Yeah, you might want to, people might want to go back and read that and see why I'm bringing it up right now. But a lot, when we go into these cases, I agree with Harold that all persons have names. That's how I would interpret what you just said. All persons have names. Man in the system is unidentified. Ed brought that out. We're not we are non-resident and alien to the United States. That's what I interpreted what Ed said on regards to that. But even so, I wouldn't even think that any of us would have to identify ourselves with any words, phrases, or magical woo-hoo language, because what he also brought out, and I think this is really important, and it's actually focusing and taking the sunlight and putting the magnifying glass onto the paper here tonight so we can get a nice hot look at it, is this is the subject of special appearance. This is the substance of a special appearance. And, you know, there's people, I'm not going to mention any names out there, that have the never-ending affidavit of the I am not. And, you know, I think that's really ridiculous when you come down to it, because when you have to sit there and think that you've got I am not 100 different items on a point there, when your adversary hasn't proven the very one element that Ed brought out in this call tonight, who's the one that's the child here? Who's the master and who's the servant? So I'm just encouraging everybody to take the shift tonight. If you have been on the never-ending affidavit or any of that kind of garbage that is trying to defend yourself by making affidavits and putting the burden of proof upon yourself and forgetting that you've forgotten, maybe it was never in your ancestry line, I don't know how that works, but in our jurisprudence, American jurisprudence, we're always the one that said prove it. And, you know, Missouri said show me. They were the show me state. I'm just thinking that that's a real good attitude to take when we are trying to
you might say, get the boot off our neck. So I'm really excited about this call. I'm excited about the miscellaneous file. I don't know if there's such a thing as a green file. I can see why the numbers are low, by the way, Ed, in miscellaneous filings, because there's not as many miscellaneous filings as there would be in federal cases. So that doesn't create a big mystery for me as far as the low numbering. However, I don't know if there's such a thing as a green file, but I can see where a miscellaneous filing might be different business than the United States District Court. And from all that I can read on Title 28, the District Court is dealing with a specific class of persons within a district. And perhaps that might be why people are having, you know, more success or easier success dealing with a miscellaneous filing. I can't say yay or nay on that. I really don't have an educated opinion. All I can have is a guess. But there might be a few of us on this call that might like to squeak something through to the District Court of the United States of America. Isn't that how you put it, Ed? The District Court of the, capital T, United States of America?
Yeah, the District Court is in lowercase letters, by the way. The District Court of the United States is a complete and separate entity from the United States District Court. They did that back in 1959. I shared a paper that I wrote, a letter that I wrote to a federal district court judge explaining, I believe it was Kloffman v. Houseman, that explained that the courts, the district courts no longer had concurrent jurisdiction. Concurrent jurisdiction meaning they can decide federal and state law. They no longer have that power, and that's why they changed the name. So what you did, when you write the header on your complaint, you write it in the district court, all lowercase letters, of, and then you capitalize the T in the United, capitalized States, capitalize of America. So you capitalize the United States of America, the first letter. So in the district court, all lowercase letters of the United States of America. Add that of America because the United States is acting on behalf of the United States of America. That means we're not dealing with the de jure government. We're dealing with the de facto government. The corporation, and all corporations are for profit. So that's how they get away with it. So in the District Court of the United States, and like I said, I had a case last Friday that went in. Her case number was VC-411, and Ron Kelly assured me that if you want, the only way you can get to an Article III court in federal district court is to file it in under miscellaneous in the green file. And when she did it, the clerk took it right away, filed it under miscellaneous in this mythic green file, and now she's entitled to an Article III court. And she said she could tell something was different after because the clerk called her, gave her the number after it was submitted, and she said, you're going to be going to, not to the regular courtroom, but to an annex room of the courtroom in the I think it was the Hoover something building where she lives. So it was in the Southern District, the Middle District of Georgia. Georgia has three: Northern, Middle, and Southern. So she's in the Middle District Court, whatever the name of that building is. But the clerk's already informed her that she'll be going to an annex chamber of the district court. So, and I bet you when she walks in there, I'll bet you a dollar to a donut, and this is how I'll know for sure, when she goes to swear out her complaint, I'll bet you that the judge is sitting behind the bench, on the bench, with a civil flag behind him and not an admiralty flag. That'll tell me for sure. Admiralty flag being what? Three sides, yellow fringe. And then I'll know.
And a lot of times, those types of cases actually are handled in chambers and not in open court.
That could be what annexed room means. It could be in chambers.
Yeah. Yeah. But what you're saying is, I'm familiar with the green file, but like Daniel says, I never saw any proof, but I've heard about it, and I did know about the district court of and the lower case and the United States of America. Just citing that requires an Article 3 judge because that goes all the way back to the Articles of Confederation, where the first article was the styling of the name of the country, and it was capital T, United States of America. So that would automatically put that in another jurisdiction.
Right. The other thing is a lot of people aren't aware that we have two Supreme Courts today. We have the U.S. Supreme Court, all capital
and Supreme Court. Right.
And then Supreme Court lowercase letters of the United States of America. So
I call that the back door. That's the back door to the court.
That's where the 90 farts are. That's where the 90 farts are, the Supreme Court of the United States. But I know for a fact if you look up United States Supreme Court, when you look it up on Google, you're going to see the letters GAO, and that stands for General Administrative Offices. So just so everybody's aware of the, you know, I'm trying to make you aware of the fraud because there's a lot of fraud. But, yes, one point that Daniel made that I want to reiterate, I'm not arguing the merits of the case anymore. I'm not bringing up the fact that I can challenge subject matter jurisdiction at any time. I'm not bringing any of that into play. I'm not even filing my fabled bill of particulars that is yet to be one question answered. I'm not bringing up any of that. I'm just saying, first, you have to prove that I'm a U.S. citizen and that the statutes that you've charged me with apply to me. And that's it. That's all you got to do. We file this one document, which everybody on the call tonight is going to get a copy of it when we get done. And when Chris and I and our other partner get this done, we're going to try to share it. But more importantly, I would like to say that everybody that's on this call tonight, share it with everybody you know, because they need to understand what's happening too. And I think I said it pretty clearly tonight, where everybody can understand the argument that we're making, and it's an argument that they can't win. And remember, civil or criminal, that's huge in our business. Civil or criminal, it doesn't matter. They first have to prove that the statutes that they're charging you with apply to you and that you are a U.S. citizen, because that's all statutes ever applied to was their U.S. citizen subjects. And with that, I'll yield.
Hey, Ed.
Can I jump in?
I jumped in first.
Go ahead.
Hey, Ed, if you have a case that's ongoing, can you go to the court clerk and ask that case be transitioned to the Dream File?
In federal district court?
In federal district court.
Okay, did you file a complaint or was something filed against you?
We filed a complaint.
Okay, yes, tell her you made an honest mistake and you'd like to file your case, refile your case. You know, the other beauty of doing the Green File, and you'll know that it works, my girl in Tifton only paid $47 to file her case when she filed it under miscellaneous in the Green File. I think everybody else that files it in the regular district court the regular way pay like $502 or something like that, something ridiculous.
We paid $402.
Okay, so, maybe it was $402 here as well. But when you file it under miscellaneous in the Green File, not only do you get an Article 3 court, but you also only pay $47 to file it. Think about that, folks.
Hey, Ed, would that preclude the lawyers from coming in and answering for these evil deed doers?
Okay, I don't know how long you've listened to me talk, but the last thing you want is a lawyer. And if somebody will share with this gentleman a copy of my client-attorney agreement, it's one paragraph, sir.
No, you're right. Hey, you misunderstood my question, Ed.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Say it again.
The claimant makes a claim,
and you make the claim against some evildoers, disorderly deed doers, they send their lawyers to answer for you, and they try to get a 12B6 and a 12B2 ruling, or 12B5 motion against you to have the case thrown out. If you have a Article 3 court, does that not preclude the lawyers from coming in and taking over your case?
In an Article 3 court, sir, an attorney has no standing. They can only say what you allow them to say. You bring the action, you bring the law. And the law is that unless they have firsthand knowledge of the complaint that you made, they have to sit down and shut up.
That was my question.
John,
Thank you very much.
You want to chime in, John, on that? What I just said?
Tomorrow, you need to go through that.
Yeah, the courts have already ruled. There's court cases out there that say that lawyers can't testify, and all that. That body of law is already in place. I mean, all they're doing is beating their gum and wasting air. If they don't have any firsthand knowledge, and then they can't testify even if they do have firsthand knowledge. They have to call somebody else. So what they can do is strictly limited to whatever the rules call for. I mean, they can write motions and file stuff and do this and that and regular duties that would be done by a lawyer. But as far as them getting up there and representing a case without facts or testimony, all that stuff can't happen.
I got a comment there, guys, just for clarity. If your Title 42 action or your action is naming an entity such as a corporate body politic, there will be a lawyer that appears in that action.
Yeah, but in Article 3 court, he has no standing. He can't argue.
Well, if you're bringing a corporate entity into a question, like you're claiming that these people that have gathered together and have done their dastardly deeds in the name of whatever it would be, there will be somebody that's a spokesman coming up and speaking for, because the entity, as we all know, cannot speak.
That's
well,
the beauty
yeah,
of it.
What would happen?
Support the record with affidavits and things like that, because he can't basically testify himself, but he can offer evidence such as affidavits and testimony and from other people and things like that. Now, that'll be the extent that he can do. He can't get up there and start mouthing off, because whatever he says doesn't amount to a hill of beans. But the test, so when he shows up to argue, he'll show up with he has to show up with affidavits and the witnesses to the affidavits, so you can cross examine them. And that's how the trial has to go forward in a situation like that. How are you?
That can I interject experience?
Please.
I've just dealt with that this summer in the summary judgment hearing, and I probably didn't get everything into the evidence as needed, but during the hearing, I rebutted, all the supposed facts. I brought up Trinzi versus Pagliaro with the attorney thing, and how he could not do that, and where's the witness to this, to the affidavit. And the judge just went right against me. He just moved on. And I'm not the best at this, but the judge shouldn't have done that. And John, you might be interested in the reply I got from the judge when I requested clarification on his order on how to pay.
What do you say?
I'd have to read it, but I can get it to you through Daniel or something. But it was, the thing that stands out in my mind is something of a cash equivalent. But he did also state that's how to pay, because I used your argument. But that's one of the things I didn't get into the record properly, probably is evidence. I submitted it to the.
Well, there's no cash in circulation. There's only debt notes. So there's nothing to send him.
Yep.
This is Jake from Delhi, Iowa. Daniel, if I could.
Please do, Jake.
I received the notice from the court just today. Somewhere in this notice, they wrote, in this type of case, you are not entitled to what is called a bill of particulars.
Is it a criminal case?
No, they said this is not a criminal proceeding nor a civil contempt proceeding, and nothing you have submitted supports that an attorney would be appointed for you for this type of hearing.
Okay, you tell them that you can afford your own attorney, and they can only appoint one if you can't. But you're having a problem getting effective assistance of counsel because no state bar attorney will sign your client attorney agreement and enter it into the record so that they can represent you. Are you the plaintiff or the defendant, or the respondent? Are you the plaintiff or the respondent in the matter?
The respondent.
Okay. Do they call you a respondent in the case, or do they call you a defendant?
The respondent. That's what they call me.
Okay. Okay. So here's the thing. Question number one on your bill of particulars, and also the question that asks what are each and every one of the elements that have to be proven in order to gain a conviction. I think it's question 14. Those must be answered in civil or criminal court. So there are parts of your bill of particulars that do apply, especially question number one. The case law for that is McNutt, MCNUTT versus General Motors Acceptance Corporation, which says that the asserter that has to prove jurisdiction on the record, and the court is only supposed to judge on the sufficiency of the evidence presented. Along with what you learned tonight about U.S. citizenship, you can also amend your complaint to add those two questions and add a third question. And the question is, has the asserter proven that I'm a U.S. citizen on the record of this case? And then you can cite the laws that I gave you earlier tonight in support of the fact that they must prove that you're a U.S. citizen and that the statutes that they charge you with apply to you.
And then, Jake, I will talk to you about that some more. I can get you some of this information. I know that you're limited with the as far as internet and what have you. So I'll get that. This is Jake, Ed, we were talking about. Well, guys, it's 9:30. I'm getting ready to turn into a pumpkin. I know Dave's got some errand running to do, and we've had a packed conversation. I want to tell everybody that joined into this call tonight that I appreciate everybody's attention to the details. It's a very good call. Try to pass it around to your friends, neighbors, and loved ones. I'd like to see this information getting more out to the just under 100 people that we get it to. I'd like to see it get it to hundreds. This is good information. We've got some really good calls. So if I could encourage you to pass the information on to friends and loved ones so that we can get the word out some more and help more people. This is, as you can tell, those of you that have been involved in this phone on these messages, we're non-commercial. Nobody's selling anybody anything. Nobody's hitting anybody up for money. And just a free expression of getting the boot off your neck. With that, I'd just like to say good night, arrivederci, God bless you, Godspeed. I hope nobody missed out on being able to speak their mind and heart on this open forum tonight, and I love you all. Any comments there? Good night. Anybody going to say good night to me? I'm going to feel bad if no one says good night to me.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was good.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Good night.
Thanks.
This was a great call.
It was a good call. I'm going to go back and listen to this one on Sabbath. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's
fantastic.
Thank you, everybody.
Good night.
Good night, y'all. Thanks.